right, I believe this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts, followers and persuasions, welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, who can't remember his own intro podcast spiel, aka Some Gadget Guy, which is the SGG of this terribly named podcast series. So thank you for joining, but the QA, SGGQA, that's the important part, as we want to make this a more interactive conversation. We're going to look at some of the top tech news stories over the last week, maybe some tech broke over the weekend, maybe some embargoes lifted really, really late, and we can finally start talking about some cool gear. That's why I like to hold my show on a Monday, so that we can kind of dig in, we can kind of sort out our feels, and we can really get a feeling on as these tech stories evolve. More than just reading a headline on the Bird site and getting real anger and up in your feels about it, I like to see how these things play out over time. I'm already seeing an incredible group of folks in the live chat. I'm seeing Sam and Barry, Flowtech Wolf, Fat Produce, Bray Gray, Barry Johnson. What is up, Barry Johnson? Dustadore, Oliver Lundstrom, Kaba Cash, Simon Says Hypno, Baker Jeremy, Fungi 455, Ownscon. It's going by too fast. It's going too fast. You go too fast. I feel like Salieri here. It was a terrible reference for a tech podcast. I think I said Darren. We've got a good group already. I'm also trying something a little different. Hey, everybody on my phone right here, seeing if there's another kind of live stream. I'll be checking in on the chat with you folks, too. And apparently, we just hit a hype train here on the Twitch. Fat Produce is gifting tier one subs. He's gifted a tier one sub to Mind Your Helm. Jman150 has subscribed at tier one. My favorite guy who makes fun of me, Dave Burns, already did a subscribe while we were in the pre-show. So thank you very much. Apparently, we're already in level two of a hype train. So my entire morning spiel has already been derailed. We've got so much stuff to dig into. There is so much crazy news. My news block was like three times longer than what we're actually going to talk about. We've been chatting up a whole bunch of stuff on the Discord. There's a whole bunch of like AI news that's hitting the feeds. There's a whole bunch of like social media drama. Blue Sky invites are going out. What does it mean for policing social media and protecting the children? There is so much happening. So I hope everybody had a lovely weekend. I'm not going to spend a lot of time prefacing. I spent most of yesterday down at the beach on a very cold gray day outside near the Pacific Ocean, and I loved it, and I need to do that way more often. So expect in I put the phone down and now I can't find it. Expect in my Xiaomi 13 Ultra coverage, lots of pictures of my family down at the beach. I took a lot of photos down at the beach. So, Fat Produce says, I would have subbed myself, but someone gifted me a sub the other week. See, that's what I'm loving. See, just thank you so much. Thank you, everybody who's supporting and kind of jumping in on the Twitch here. That's super kind of you, and I'm really stoked that you guys are digging the stream. So, yes, hope everybody had a lovely time. I want to jump straight into some housekeeping, because like I said, the dams broke on a whole bunch of news real quick. Gabaletta, subscriber prime. They've been subscribed for 20 months. Thank you, Gabaletta. I very much appreciate the support. Thank you. I'm going to go into a quick screen share here on the main feed, and what we've got a bunch of things. Biggie, A number one, we've got the OnePlus Pad video. So this is my first look at the OnePlus Pad. We're going to be talking about that in the second half of this week's show for the gadget block. Then the Xiaomi 13 Ultra. So I got my Xiaomi 13 Ultra just a little bit after all those other tech channels, maybe some of the people who are actually flown out to China to play with the phone. Man, they shipped that phone out quick. So I got my hands on it. I've already shot almost 20 gig of photo and video samples, so there's going to be a lot to talk about. I already have some very strong feelings and some very strong first impressions. But Xiaomi 13 Ultra, you can at least see my first 20 hours of using that phone. Real quick, we got... Oh, wait, I should get out of screen share for this. Hold on. We've got Simon Says Hypno, subscribed with Prime. They've been subscribed for 25 months. Simon, thank you so much, Simon. I really appreciate that. That's really awesome of you. All right, and... then, I also posted a quick question here because I'm wrapping up Vivo X90 Pro main coverage, talking about, you know, the camera quality and where I think the phone fits in terms of competition. So I put out this video, do you use action stabilizer modes on your phone camera? And specifically, we're looking at the Pixel 7 Pro and the Vivo X90 Pro, but this could go for any number of other phones too. And so I put that out, that video. I think I'm going to try and dig into some of those comments. So if I get some good comments on that, I might do like a reply video or an answer video. But it really was like, here's a sample of what the image stabilization looks like. I don't think it looks that bad. Lots of people that were commenting on like, oh, I don't know, I heard another phone was better for image stabilization. And that kind of stuff just gets silly. So that was the main SomeGadgetGuy.com stuff that went up on the Patreon. We also had a quick look, some early shots from the Xiaomi 13 Ultra. I'm a sucker for flower macros and snail shells and, you know, walking around and getting some fun shots of nature. So that post went up. Oh, I should, yeah, there it goes. That post went up. And then this was the biggie, 25 minutes of conversation about the Vivo X90 Pro camera. The deep dive is live. So there was a lot to kind of dig into and a lot to chew up because that's a very interesting camera phone to talk about. The Vivo X90 Pro, which is somewhere on my desk over here. Yeah, here it is. Vivo X90 Pro. This phone, I wasn't quite sure where to place this phone. It's they call it a Pro. It kind of doesn't feel like a Pro, but... It's definitely not an Ultra, but it's got an Ultra feature. It's a really interesting animal. And so a part of this video isn't just digging into all the camera samples and comparisons and, ooh, let's pixel peep a little. It's also just trying to talk about, like, philosophically, where would we put a phone like the Vivo X90 Pro? So that video is now live. That's a Patreon exclusive. And yeah, it's a 25-minute video. It's almost wall-to-wall photo samples because the camera's real good. It's really good. It even with the Xiaomi 13 Ultra here, it makes a very specific play to being one of my favorite stills cameras of the year. And we've got Vince Novoa gifting a tier one sub to Cryptic. Thank you so much, Vince. That's really kind of you. And Cryptic, hey. What's up, buddy? Where was I? I think that wraps us up for housekeeping. So all of the stories and videos that I just talked about, those will be available in the show notes, along with all of the other tech news that we're going to be talking about for this week's show. And I know, so I missed it in the chat, but someone was saying like, oh, you need to do a soundboard. And you're like, yeah, I'm real bad at the live streaming and the podcasting. Like, I run Twitch at such a bare minimum. Like, no clue. But a soundboard at some point will be something that I think I need to invest in. What I actually need to do is also, like, all of the reactions and, like, sound tags that other people can participate with. Yeah. All of the show notes, all of the links, everything that we're going to be talking about, all the videos, everything will be available when the audio version of this live stream goes live, and you can catch that on somegadgetguy.com. J1Man50 was telling me to check my posture and to stretch, and I'm going to take a quick slurp of coffee, so hold on one sec. Delicious. All right. We've got a ton of crazy news to get through. So, we should jump into that. Some gadget guy, you can get one to run on a cheap Android tablet. Yeah. I mean, I know that there are plenty of ways. Right now, okay, before we jump into the news, Dave, loves derailing my podcast. I'm already off the rails. My current setup is held together with like spit and chewed up wads of gum and chicken wire. It's like the least professional setup. And what I need to do is start cutting and eliminating pieces, because I just keep sort of adding things to my equipment chain and then shoehorning them into things that probably don't work the way that they should. And so what I need to do is kind of wipe it, start fresh, and plan. Build for how do I import audio better. Like right now, if I add my Steam Deck, like if I want to do a game stream with my Steam Deck kind of driving that, you know, doing the video out and the audio out, I can very easily get the video to incorporate in this. And you've seen me do second cam. Unfortunately, I can't do second cam today. I've done second cam. The audio is always sort of what's problematic. And so adding the soundboard is actually one of the bigger challenges that I've been facing is my audio setup, especially because I want to stay wireless. I want to be able to move around. If I have just the mic right here, right up on the side of my face, and I have to hold my head like this for 2 hours straight, I can't. Way too like fidgety, and that's kind of gross. So I gotta figure it out. I gotta like think through it and re-diagram. Like, I want audio to come from here and go there and not be distorted. How does that work? Hassam is acting, hey Juan, what are your thoughts on the Asus ROG Ally? We're going to be talking about that in the second half of the show in the gadget block, and I have some very excited big feels for what Asus could bring to that table. And Baker Jeremy says, I'm in the lower end budget range for a new phone. I'm in the States and pretty much stuck between Metro by T-Mobile and Boost. I've narrowed down my choices down to the Nord N300, Galaxy A14, Moto G Stylus 5G on the Metro side. That's the okay. So hold on to that question, Baker, Baker Jeremy, 3736. And maybe if we've got some time at the end, because I try to do a little Q&A at the end, we can dig into that a little bit more. Because right now, I've got to get into actual news. See, Dave, look what you did to me, Dave. Oh, man. All right, here we go. Let me get this out of the way. JMan150, you're asking a question about a gadget that we will talk about in the gadget blog. I want to start off, so in the news block, if there is a story about tech politics, we got to get that out of the way first. And I'm not, in the show notes, I'm not going to be linking to an editorial on this topic. I'm linking directly to this. This is the announcement of a bill coming by way of Senator Markey out of Massachusetts. And this is I don't know what the actual bill name is. Hold on. There we go. Introduce the bipartisan and bicameral Block Nuclear Launch by Autonomous Artificial Intelligence Act. The BNLAAIA. The BNLAAIA. So, in a very concise, in a very brief summation of what this bill is about, basically, we've got senators, and we've got a pretty even split, a bipartisan split of senators and representatives that are introducing a bill that would always include a human in the loop for national defense, especially as it pertains to nuclear armaments. I've been ironically saying nuclear so much that now I actually have to think about saying nuclear. I know how to pronounce nuclear. Sadly, sometimes I need to think about it because I think it's funny, but now I've actually started training my mouth to say it wrong. This is a very interesting development as AI is exploding in a number of applications and in a number of consumer uses. I'm really kind of happy to see a few senators and a few Congress people looking at the potential of future AI applications. Now, this is a very specific use. It's talking about dropping nukes, but keeping a human, you know, pushing the final button, the final say. I hope that this is a building trend. We are nowhere near the military applying machine learning algorithms to launching these types of weapons. But it's nice, it's kind of refreshing to see some of our politicians getting ahead of a potential concern And I feel like that's appropriate. What I'd like to see is for philosophers and for scientists to start having the beginnings of those conversations about emerging consciousness. Right now, we've got a bunch of people that are like, oh, it's just a couple lines of code. Why would you care? Blah, 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 blah. But by the time we get to software that can emulate human emotions and human feelings to the degree that we would be worried about harm, we'll probably be way past it if we start the debate when we start getting to that point. This is a great example of being just a step more proactive than we probably need to be, but I'm here for it because I feel like it's way better to have the conversation before we're running into problems with autonomous weapons platforms. I think autonomous weapons platforms are probably not a great idea. I've seen way too many science fiction films. The Frankenstein complex. Man was not meant to play God, and then his creation rises up. And I, for one, welcome our new AI robot overlords. So, yeah, Brian Glaze. Hold on. Brian says, yeah, it's amazing to me that people are conflating language learning models with general AI. But what I'm happy about is language learning models that are good enough to trick a lot of people into believing that there's an emerging consciousness. Oh, who, someone please link this. I think we even shared it on the Discord. She does a whole bunch of video essays, and she did a video about a company that made, like, AI girlfriends. Can someone look up in the Discord? It might have been in the entertainment tab. I can't remember who did it. But it was a really lovely examination of 2 years through the global pandemic. There was this company that made this. Again, it's a language learning model. It's not any fancy AI, but they trained it to kind of replicate. Sarah Zed. Thank you, Dave Burns. So she made an incredible video about her experiences using it. And, you know, we were all in lockdown. We were all kind of freaking out. And the company's business practices became really predatory. Like, people who were at their most vulnerable, who were already predisposed to being somewhat antisocial or having issues interacting with other people, kind of got caught up in this language learning model program of like having a companion or a girlfriend or a friend. And then they changed the business model and affected how the AI could interact with people. So we're already at that point. We're already at that point where business decisions can cause palpable psychological harm to people based on their emotional attachment to a couple lines of code. I don't think we're too far from having that conversation about if an AI can replicate emotional harm to a degree that it's convincing to humans, what does that say about our society if we're creating software that can be emotionally harmed? So that's what I'd like us to get ahead of. I want us to talk about it before it really does become more problematic. Oh, Dave Burns, thank you. Hold on. Let me see if I can copy that link. I'll try to drop that in the main chat. I'm real good at the podcasting, as you can see. oh, yes, excellent. So here's the link, copy link, and paste the link, and hopefully that shows up, because I don't really know what I'm doing here. So again, I'm linking directly to the bill. This is exactly what the senators are talking about, what they're trying to create a precedent, building it into law that these types of weapon systems have to have a human in the loop. And genuinely, I'd like this to be the tip of the spear so that all weapons platforms have some kind of human in the loop. If it's a sentry machine gun at an encampment that's automatically targeting and looking at movement on the horizon, I would prefer a human actually push the button as to whether or not that machine gun is going to fire. We can already set up alarms, and we can set up laser lighting systems, and we can do everything else. Let all of the automation take over until the moment where something might be eradicated from the planet, and then a human has to decide, is that really what we want to have happen here? Oh, and Easy's in the building. What up, Easy? Easy, have you put in your order for the Xiaomi 13 Ultra yet? I think you would like that phone quite a bit, Easy. All right, moving right along. Easy Computer Solutions is a good friend of mine, and you should also check out his channel, too. So, I also wanted to point to this one here real quick. Ars Technica, this is coming by way of Dan Gooden. Let me screen share that. So this is a really solid, I love the way that Ars writes up their articles, because it's really long form and they put in lots of sources and they show lots of examples. This one is talking about the current sort of fear spread on this practice called juice jacking. So there were all of these like PSAs that kind of hit the internet all at the same time, like, oh, you know those kiosks that you can charge your phone on? Well, they're going to steal all of your data. And you know, that kind of makes sense. I plugged my phone in, and it could be a computer that I plugged my phone into, and maybe it is trying to siphon off all my data. But if you're like me, then you've probably done some things like, you know, if you plug your phone into a PC, it asks you, hey, are you trying to transfer files? And you say, nah. And then you're fine. And then the computer can't really see what's on the phone. So this article from Ars Technica, the title is "Those Scary Warnings of Juice Jacking in Airports and Hotels, They're Nonsense. Juice jacking attacks on mobile phones are non-existent, so why are we so afraid?" From the article, again, Dan Gooden, I really like his work over at Ars Technica. "Federal authorities, tech pundits, and news outlets want you to be on the lookout for a scary cyber attack that can hack your phone when you do nothing more than plug it into a public charging station. These warnings of juice jacking, as the threat has come to be known, have been circulating for more than a decade. Earlier this month, though, juice jacking fears hit a new high when the FBI and Federal Communications Commission issued new, baseless warnings that generated ominous-sounding news reports from hundreds of outlets. NPR reported that the crime is becoming more prevalent, possibly due to the increase in travel. The Washington Post said, it's a significant privacy hazard that can identify loaded web pages in less than 10 seconds. CNN warned that just by plugging into a malicious charger, quote, your device is now infected. And a Fortune headline admonished readers, don't let a free USB charge drain your bank account. But it doesn't work that way. The rest of this article, and again, I really, really, really want you to go through this Ars article. So again, anytime that I'm kind of putting these up, like, I'm not going to read through the whole thing, because I feel like that is taking away traffic that should be done, that you should be going to Ars Technica because they do such good work. This is an incredible, incredibly well-researched article on all of the potential threat vectors and how they really play out in real life and how phenomenally unlikely it is that you are being impacted or you are being affected by this if you need to top off your phone. Now, of course, with the people that I have in this chat, who are all very tech savvy, very, very tech savvy, I'd be kind of curious. Let me just kind of see in the chat real quick here. How many people have recently used some kind of public charging apparatus that like you actually plug it into something that like one of those kiosks, like in the airport, you know, you've got like a bank of little cubbies and you plug your phone into a cubby and it charges that way. Because I have not used one of those since the Lumia 930 was launched. And I went to South by Southwest and I ran, what did I have at the time? I think I had, I might have had like a Galaxy S1. And I ran my phone so hard that I nuked two of those little tube Nokia smartphone chargers. And ever since then, I have traveled with some kind of battery pack because I'm a Boy Scout, I was an Eagle Scout, and I'm enough of a nerd that I can't handle the idea of being away from power. How many have anyone have any of you have any of you? I want to see. Okay, so well, first of all, I just like this quote from Raj. Juice jacking sounds like something a cool hacker would do in a Fast and Furious movie. It does. This is my hot rod phone. It's turbocharged. Arthur Lee, me, tech savvy? Nonsense. Barry Johnson saying, not me. Let's see. See, same for me. Kemi is saying not once since like a decade ago. Sep is saying I don't trust kiosks. Brian is saying I haven't used one in a long time. Onscon, my library has chargers built into their tables and desks. No issues so far. That's good. Actually, that's really cool. And that kind of goes along with, I really hope that we see more restaurants kind of take on that initiative of building like wireless chargers into cafe tables, you know, things like that. Like Starbucks, I thought was kind of ahead of the curve. That was an interesting move. And you're not plugging your phone into anything. It's also the plugging in. This is so silly. And especially coming out of a global pandemic, I feel justified, but also I know I'm being ridiculously oversensitive about something like this. It's also just how many people have handled that cable? How much gunk has been in someone else's USB port, like from pocket lint on up to other stuff? And then that's just kind of getting like passed back and forth. I'm less concerned about the digital threat as I am like, what could be festering and living on those other cables? And how do you clean publicly accessible USB cables or lightning connector cables? Like, that just seems kind of gross to me, not dangerous in any kind of cybersecurity way. So I thought wireless pads, go to an airport and they often have those like business cubbies where someone can set up a laptop and you just put a pad there and you could charge off of that if you have the wireless charging. Kemi is saying many of us have a power bank. I always use a portable battery for charging devices. That's from Snorkel. Let's see. I don't use public charging or public Wi-Fi almost ever. Jonathan Blade, I use public Wi-Fi a lot, but I am real aggressive about firing up that VPN. I've never used one of those. Power banks on the go from Fungi, JMX Warrior. I haven't used one of those because I haven't needed, but I use the wireless charging pad in McDonald's in the tables. Dave Burns, I always just bring my fast chargers. See, Dave knows, like, I have such a collection of OnePlus chargers now that they're all over the house. And whenever we travel, I bring like a couple things, like a laptop hub. So I have extra USB ports, but then I bring like three OnePlus chargers. So yeah, that's kind of my jam. Okay. So I think we're all kind of on the same page here. It's not something that if you're tech comfortable, like we are, we're the ones that are probably charging up all of our family and friends' gadgets because we bring an oversized power bank. But it just seems really unlikely to me that if you're in a situation, you have no other recourse left, you didn't have a charger, and you absolutely need to get some juice in your phone, the security threat of juice jacking seems real little. Real, real little. And Ars Technica has a ton of data to back that up. We don't have to spend a lot of time on this one. I'm going to take a quick drink of coffee just to jump in before. NYC Transport Authority. Woof. NYC's Transport Authority will no longer post service alerts on Twitter. They said paying Twitter $50,000 a month for API access wouldn't be the best use of their resources. Who'd have thunk it? Boy, howdy. Twitter not monetizing very intelligently. This is written up by Mariella Moon over at Engadget. NYC commuters will no longer see service alerts and other informative posts from the Metropolitan Transport Authority, the MTA, on Twitter. The agency runs several accounts that provide passengers with useful real-time updates, such as whether a particular route or train has been suspended. But now it has posted a farewell message on the website explaining that Twitter is no longer reliable for providing the consistent updates that riders expect. While it didn't elaborate on why it's leaving the social network, Bloomberg says it's because the company was asking the MTA to fork over $50,000 a month for access to the API. And every single time, so here's the deal. I don't want to yuck anyone's yum. If you're subscribed to Twitter Blue and you're getting a benefit out of that and you feel like that $8 a month for your personal channel is getting you there and you're getting all the benefits, great. I honestly would have paid for Twitter Blue if they hadn't tied account verification to Twitter Blue. The rest of the things are kind of cool. Like, and I am one who wants to support good software, and I kind of, you kind of have to grok at this point that the Web 2.0 model of put out a free service and run it until it gets popular is unsustainable. At some point, you need to monetize, and genuinely, I'd rather just pay a company directly than deal with the awful trends of how they monetize with ads and siphoning off user data. I know that still would have happened on Twitter, but for me, account verification was a bridge too far because it destroys the credibility of the platform. And I know the obvious joke is, well, but Twitter was already a cesspool and who would use that? And I'm glad it's dying, blah, 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 blah. But what we lost was a platform, imperfect as it was, that was really good at sending a text message to a huge number of people. A broadcast megaphone. This is happening in this moment right now. And before Musk took over, the algorithm did not get in the way of the timeliness of the announcement. It's what killed me for using Instagram as often for posting photos. Is I would go through my Instagram feed and I loved seeing what my friends were doing in that moment. I'm using Instagram way less because now it's, I might see like this amazing announcement and then I'll look down and it's like, that was posted 2 days ago. Now I look like a jerk friend. Twitter was my last refuge for that kind of, this is the moment that the thing is happening. And now I've moved most of my attention over to Mastodon for that very same reason. When I talk about the platform not delivering me $8 a month worth of value, it's this kind of erosion of confidence that I'm talking about. Twitter as a platform is not succeeding in the mission of why I enjoyed using Twitter anymore. And other organizations are pulling useful services from the platform because of the way that the platform is trying to monetize, and they're doing it very, very poorly. We also briefly talked about, we didn't really cover it that deeply, but the Microsoft was going to be pulling from their ad network. And now Elon Musk is even trying to talk about suing Microsoft because they're not going to be incorporating Twitter publishing into some of their other platforms. But Microsoft has no obligation to pay Twitter for that. Again, Elon Musk really wants free market when he gets tax dollars from the United States government, but really hates free market when companies decide not to do business with his organizations. The mind of a billionaire. So we get to this point, and there's no way. There fundamentally, a state-run organization like the MTA is going to set aside a budget of $50,000 a month to update passengers as to what's going on. That is absolutely absurd to think that that's how Elon Musk is going to fuel the profits of Twitter. And again, it really seems to me that Musk only exists to avoid paying taxes and then try to find profit vectors that use as much taxpayer dollars as possible. If it's SpaceX and Starlink, mostly government contracts. Even Tesla. One of the biggest sources of revenue for Tesla are the number of vehicles that are now being purchased for things like state organizations. I want to say there was something like part of the highway patrol here in California was looking at investing a lot of money and buying a bunch of Teslas. It seems every single time we go down this path, Elon Musk's, one of his main profit vectors is, how can I get more taxpayer dollars to fund my companies? But I don't want to pay taxes. That's bad. So hopefully that we see that this is Dave Burns brought this up on the Discord. This is an incredible opportunity for the examination of alternatives. And obviously I've been hyping up Mastodon, and I wish more people were giving Mastodon a try, because if you want that old flavor of social media, it is glorious. There's like nothing in your way. It's funny because you have to put up with every post having a bunch of hashtags, but the hashtags are actually the things that you want to use, because you can subscribe to the Android hashtag, then click on that, and there's your Android feed in real time. No manipulation of content. If it was posted that second, you get it that second, and you get it in the order that it was posted on, and it's amazing. We could use some more people just posting Android stuff on Mastodon. There's a wonderful opportunity to kind of help take over tech conversations because all of the different servers, it's kind of a little insular. So anyway, so really a wonderful opportunity to start looking at alternatives, and maybe the MTA could set up their own sort of federated server and then build that just into the backbone of an MTA app. So you could get your alerts on Mastodon, or you could have a dedicated MTA app with all of that same information. The backbone of it would be a Mastodon server, and that would work just as well. And it would be way cheaper than $50,000 a month. It's just so really silly. Really, really silly. All right, moving right along. I'm way behind on news. I got to pick this up a little bit. How many do I have? Okay, two more stories for the news block. We're going to plug the subreddit. And then get into the gadget block, because the gadget block is just bonkers silly this year. Aditya, oh, that's a good question. Aditya asks, what about Blue Sky? So Blue Sky needs to hit, Blue Sky needs to hit a quantity of users, a tipping point of users, before we see the usefulness of Blue Sky resemble what made Twitter so handy. Again, it's one of my favorite stories, is during the Boston Marathon bombings, my good friend Shaka Armstrong, he's here in Los Angeles, immediately was on Twitter fielding news. He was trying to get interviews from people that were near the site or could comment on what happened. But one of the things that, I mean, I'm going to love Shaka like a brother for the rest of my life. He immediately started coordinating with people on the ground who could offer shelter and assistance to travelers who couldn't get back to hotels or who might have been, like, you know, stuck in some kind of transition or trying to get out of the area of the Boston Marathon. And Twitter became an incredible resource to connect people with the right pieces of information to keep panic at a minimum, but then to make sure that folks were supported, that they were taken care of. And for whatever we might think of Twitter in just casual or daily use, the platform always held that potential for me. You could take it seriously, you could rely on it, it could disseminate information at a shockingly fast rate, and it really could be useful for helping people. In a daily use, it can be really useful for helping people get to their train on time. But in a grander use, it could have been the platform for all of our emergency warnings, for all of our, you know, important breaking news stories. It was the social media platform of the moment. And that's what we've lost. We've lost something critical. And I cannot, in good conscience, give Elon Musk any money for destroying what I felt was so special about Twitter. Sorry. Blue Sky. Blue Sky just needs to hit that tipping point of users, and maybe it could take over. But now there is such a huge number of competing services all vying for that Twitter traffic that's kind of ebbing from some of their heavier users. I don't know. I don't really love Jack Dorsey's initial comments on moderation. He's trying to make it sound like fascists and white supremacists are going to be allowed on the platform, but maybe we'll label them. So if your sensitive liberal feelings are hurt by Nazis, then, well, what we can do is we can put a tag on them so you know not to follow those people. And that feels so inappropriate. It feels so insignificant. It's like you try to build up a social media platform on some notion of absolutist free speech, and you immediately run into problems of content moderation. And it's the same problem. We need to see if that EU lawsuit against Twitter is going to play out. So I want to see how Blue Sky really handles the policing of its own content. We need to see if the California bill has any impact on Blue Sky, where if they list in their terms of service that they have certain guidelines on content that can and can't be posted, will Blue Sky actually live up to their own terms of service? Because that's what that, again, I got that email. We talked about this a couple weeks ago. Oh, they're going to try and kill free speech in California. And the bill is, if you listed in your terms of service that you were going to do this, then you have to do it. It's just holding the company to the standard that they said they would do. That's literally all the bill is. If you put out a social media platform and you say, we're not going to have any content moderation, then technically you don't have any beef with that California bill. You'll just be sued into oblivion by every other like federal agency and country agency across the world. So, yeah. Blue Sky has a lot of uphill for me to really consider it. And I feel like the only reason why people are excited about Blue Sky right now is because it's invite only. I really feel as soon as it goes wide, people are going to be like, it's kind of just like Twitter. I'm just going to go back to Twitter. Again, it's like the surge of interest and popularity on something like Clubhouse. How many people here are still regularly using the Clubhouse? If you don't mind me also hitting the chat or, you know, hitting the stream or anything like that. I pop in occasionally, but I don't think I've been on for a couple months now. And again, I want to say initially it was, could you keep out people? If you can keep people out, then there's a surge of interest. If there's an invite system, I want to be one of the chosen ones. But the people who were kind of medium-sized on Twitter don't want to rebuild their followers from scratch. Like, they're not going to, oh, let me go to Blue Sky and do all the work to make my social media handle popular again. But yeah, like I feel like Clubhouse took so much early interest because it was iPhone only and invite only. And anytime you do that, it kind of brings out the worst in like the biggest or the most aggressive iOS fans. Like, oh, we're so special. We don't want any of those Android people. What if we get green bubbles in the chat? And if that's how you're going to do it, like, you've immediately soured me. My first impression of your social media network is like, well, then you're lame. That's dumb. Aditya saying, people got monetized on Clubhouse, and recently they kicked 50% of their employees. I have no idea what's going on with Clubhouse. Clubhouse now has a monetization program? That sounds like a terrible addition to how Clubhouse should be run. Otaku, I used Clubhouse to listen to people arguing on specific topics. It was chaos, but after a month, it got boring. I really love the idea of like an audio town hall. I mean, yeah, I'm an audio nerd. I'm a podcasting nerd. I'm speech and commercial voiceover nerd. So the idea of like social streaming and being able to invite people easily into an open conversation sounds awesome to me. But man, trying to host regular content on that kind of a platform seems wild. Excuse me, coffee burp there. All right, let's get to the next news story. Because I was like ahead of the curve and now I'm running behind again. All right, here, let me screen share this. Microsoft's headache-inducing army goggles delayed for at least 2 years. Now, we don't need to spend a lot of time on this. This is coming by way of Bloomberg, but I caught it on Yahoo Finance. An improved model of Microsoft Corp's goggles won't be deployed to the U.S. Army for at least 2 years because the company must first demonstrate it has fixed flaws that left soldiers with headaches, nausea, and eye strain, according to the Army. So I only wanted to bring this up. I got to play with HoloLens at the very beginning of the HoloLens journey. It was very rudimentary AR, but it was really, really well done. It was obviously a very manicured experience where like these little robots kind of crawl out of the walls. We were in like a living room set, so we knew it was really controlled. Like, couldn't just take this to any living room and have the same experience. We knew how manicured this was. And it borked a couple of times for people trying to run the demo. But it was incredible seeing, like, as I'm moving my head around, it is remembering things in positions and space at distances. And then you could hold out your hands and you could interact with things in your hands. It was awesome. HoloLens has been out for a while. And Microsoft has been refining their version of like corporate business and military AR since then. I mean, HoloLens was a developer platform. It was never a consumer-facing product. I regularly get comments on things like my wearable headsets. So most recently, I did a review on these. These are the Rokid Max. They're glasses that you put on, and they've got screens built into them so that you can see a projected image of a super large TV out in space in front of you. These things are awesome. This is a portable 100-inch television that fits in a shirt pocket. It's not, I mean, it has some AR head tracking capabilities and some fun little app things that you can do with it, but it's not really built for that. This is like, you want to take a giant TV with you everywhere you go, you can bring these. This is a humongous TV. That to me is the next critical step, is can we get consumers to put screens on their faces? Right now, VR and AR require goggles, like things on your head that are a lot more immersive. They're much better for, you know, gaming and interactions and stuff. But you're not going to put that in a shirt pocket and carry that with you throughout your day. You got to have like a little case for it. You got to have like a briefcase that takes it's like the difference between a laptop today and a portable suitcase computer back in like the Motorola CPU days. You know, the early DOS days. Is it IBM PC compatible? Sorry, I'm trying not to rewatch *Halt and Catch Fire* every week, but that was so dumb. Okay, so I get comments on those glasses, these glasses right here, and I regularly, almost daily, get comments from people. Well, what they need to be are smaller. They need to be smaller. Okay. Oh, but they're not good enough because you could get like a VR headset for almost the same price. But again, it's a different product. It's a different thing. It doesn't do what a VR headset does. But it needs to be like a fully enclosed computing system. Or it needs to have its own batteries and be wireless so that you can connect to things wirelessly and not be tethered on a USB-C cable. Okay? So we need a fully enclosed Oculus grade compute platform that's also wireless, that has its own batteries, and it needs to be smaller than what's currently built. Sure, that sounds like a unicorn product and magic Star Trek tech, but it's not worth buying anything ever until we get a perfect version of an imaginary AR platform that Microsoft can't make for the military. One of the world's most successful corporations in building and facilitating these government contracts, their development team, funded by U.S. military dollars, are still 2 years away from deploying an AR system for soldiers, but a really amazing portable monitor display experience is not worth buying today because it needs to be better than what Microsoft will be able to accomplish in 2 years. So never buy anything ever. Never try anything new until we can get to the imaginary version of a product, because a techie leaving comments on YouTube thinks they know what they're talking about and they have no clue what they're actually talking about. And that to me is hilarious. I mean, it's really funny. So we should be on the lookout. I want to set a calendar reminder, you know, like, okay, G, remind me in 2 years, has Microsoft shipped AR goggles to the U.S. Army? I guess, I don't know. We'll see. Simon says Hypno. I want the destination, damn it, now. It's not about the journey. It's only about the destination. What else have we got? Oh, Aditya. Oh, apparently physics is a thing. I had to bring that up. And I might make a standalone video, just an editorial, maybe all you like on YouTube or something, just saying like, hey guys, you know, when you leave me these dumb comments on my wearable displays, maybe just read the room, maybe look around, because what people are asking for, it's just so easy. I mean, you just make it wireless and you put a battery into it and you put a CPU into it and you make it smaller and then you charge less for it. It's just so easy. Just do that. And that's what passes for informed tech conversations in my YouTube comments right now. It makes me real sad. Makes me real sad. Farhan, do it. Do it. Let the hate flow through you. That's my kind of roasting. I just like using the dopey voice. I really need to be careful because, like, sometimes maybe someone actually does have an argument, but I immediately put their comment in, like, dopey voice. And maybe I should give them a moment. But it's so often. So I got into another conversation on Twitter. Was it yesterday or the day before? I posted a picture from the Xiaomi 13 Ultra, and it wasn't anything to do with competition. It wasn't like, oh, this is a better camera than another phone. It was just, I stopped down the lens to f4, and the image is razor sharp. And I shared a link to a Flickr photo. And I immediately got a reply from someone like, yeah, my Samsung already had that. Galaxy S9, just saying. And you're like, you know what? I can't let that one go. Because if you really cared about being first, then you would have been hyping the Nokia N86. The N86, 8 years before the Galaxy S9, had a variable aperture. So let's not act like Samsung was first here. And also, what I'm celebrating on the Xiaomi is not that it was first. Again, this is someone whose only YouTube contribution is being the third person to say first in a comment. I'm not celebrating that this was first to having a variable aperture. I'm celebrating that it's kind of an incredible achievement to do this with a 1-inch type sensor, something that Sony couldn't even do on the Xperia Pro I. And so I mix it up with this person, and they're like, yeah, but I mean, it's basically the same thing. I don't even understand why it would be difficult. So I start quoting him as saying, like, well, if it's so easy, why don't you let Samsung know? Because Samsung abandoned this variable aperture. And once you pinned him, it was all about, oh, you need to be better than that. Don't put words in my mouth that I never said. I never said it was easy. And you're like, you've got three posts here where you're like, it's not difficult. It's not a challenge. So apparently now this person feels that there is a substantial argument to debate the difference between it's not difficult and it's not a challenge is not the same thing as saying it's easy to do. And you're like, this conversation is a waste of electricity, is a waste of my brain power. I have used oxygen to metabolize energy and in a waste talking to someone who is that pedantic in a tech conversation. So I stopped participating. Speaking of Samsung. Oh, Gabaletta, the sensor is way smaller than half. Some gadget guy. The S9 had a variable aperture on a sensor half the size of the Xiaomi 13 Ultra. The main camera sensor on the Galaxy S9 is a 1/2.55-inch type sensor, so it's less than half the diagonal, but it is significantly less surface area. It's way less than half. When we talk about scale and surface area and sizes and dimensions, going to that, you know, two-dimensional plane as opposed to just measuring on one aspect, the 1-inch sensor gets a lot bigger than, it's more than twice as big as the Galaxy sensor. Or the same sensor that was used in the iPhone 12 Pro, $1,000 phone, had the same size image sensor as a Pixel 5. It was still a $1,000 Pro phone, but had a tiny little sensor. Okay, here, let me get this out of the way. This is, we're not going to spend a lot of time on this. We talked about it more, I want to say 2 weeks ago. I think it was, because last week was our pajama podcast. So I want to say it was 2 weeks ago, but it was just the early prediction and the expectation to shareholders. But now we have the official confirmation. This came out in Samsung's quarterlies. Again, from Ars Technica, this one written up by Ron Amadeo. Samsung makes its stunning 95% profit drop official for quarter one 2023. Over this time last year, Samsung profits are down 95%. Samsung warned the world earlier this month that its Q1 2023 earnings were going to be bad. Now the report is here, and oh boy, it's a disaster. So they went from, again, accounting for exchange rates and stuff, these are very loose numbers, about 10.7 billion from quarter one 2022 to 478 million in 2023. So this is a really big loss of, I mean, again, I want to point out, Samsung still made money. They still hit profits in a very challenging time for the tech industry. But yeah, this is a pretty critical and stunning drop in those profits. Like 5% of what they made last year in 2022. So there are a number of factors involved. I mean, I'm sure people have seen certain computer components going on radical sales, trying to move parts, trying to move systems, RAM, SSD prices. That's all very complicated. That's all very messy. The smartphone division actually held pretty steady. I want to say, someone's gonna have to quote me on this, but I want to say revenue dropped like 3% in smartphone and mobile sales, but profits actually climbed like 5%. So the manufacturing of the S23 Ultra as compared to the S22 Ultra, I think they found ways to reduce costs. And even though they technically sold about the same or less, they made more profits on what they sold thanks to those lower operating costs. If someone can check my math on that, please. But I believe that's the ebb and flow. So whenever we see these headlines like, oh man, look at these amazing sales numbers for the Galaxy S23 Ultra, excuse me, the Galaxy Note 23, they seem to be kind of hovering close to where we were for the S22 series of phones. So that's not amazing, but it's pretty good considering the dip that so many other manufacturers have felt. What's going to sting, though, is that I don't think we're seeing the same kind of consistency across all of their phones. So if it's Note 22 to Note 23, that's holding pretty steady. If it's S22s and S23s, we don't know what that looks like. And the Galaxy A series took a hammering last year, where about halfway through the year, Samsung was sitting on a stockpile of A series phones that weren't really selling up to the expectations that Samsung had. And Samsung eventually had to reduce their estimates on yearly smartphone sales. They started the year saying, we're going to sell 300 million phones. And then getting closer to the 2/3 point of the year, they said, no, we're going to adjust that. We're going to sell 270 million phones. And then they closed out 2022 and they sold 260 million phones. So it's some difficult positioning. And especially there was another story, and I can't remember who posted it now. You know, it might have been ours, actually. Some new analysts came out saying, like, we're looking at sort of the direct sales from the manufacturer. What's really spiking right now? The smartphone industry isn't losing as many sales as we think they are. But consumer patterns have shifted dramatically. More and more consumers picking up phones on sale and refurbs than buying brand new directly. So we've got some really scary trends happening where companies can kind of hit that LG-style death spiral where you wait. They want the new phone. They want the new tech. They wait 6 months to see if it goes on sale. And then if they don't really see what they want, they end up buying an even older refurb, which does not contribute to the company's profits. And you're like, that is really savvy shopping. That's great. Consumers should absolutely take advantage of that. But that also means corporations are looking at like, well, but we're not making as much money on our phones. And eventually they go on fire sale, or people love getting these phones, but they buy them as refurbs or they buy them secondhand or used. So that's a really ugly spiral to get stuck in. And that's what I think tanks companies like LG. Like, I was very concerned playing with, oh, it's way over there and I can't reach it. It's over there. It's my Motorola. I love my Motorola. But when you could buy last year's bleeding edge, almost competes with a Note 22 high-end work productivity phone, and not even a year, not even 6 months after its launch, it's on sale for $400. That's a bad trend. That's a really unhealthy place for your smartphone division to be in. So let me see. Get that out of the way there. So I think that's going to wrap us up. Samsung is in rough shape. They are not really getting it done. And I hope we see some change in direction, because right now it seems like they're trying to cut costs into higher profits as opposed to being the market leader that they advertise and promote themselves to be. And we'll have to see. We'll have to see also how a few of those like longer-term class action lawsuits play out for Samsung too. I'm gonna take a quick sip of coffee here, and then we're gonna chat the Reddit for just a second. A couple really fun posts made it to the top of the Reddit, and now drink.
Hey folks, are you getting bored of the current collection of tech and geek commentary on the internet? Is the discussion of new electronics feeling a bit stale? Do you want to find some fresh voices to add to your subscription queue? Check out the community on r glowing rectangles on Reddit. Now, this subreddit was built to help new voices in the tech community find more audience, and we need your support. Sharing, commenting, and those precious, tasty upvotes. Reddit can radically help a content creator expand their reach. Do you know a producer who deserves more attention? Do you just want to find fun new stuff? Head on over to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles and share or browse to your heart's content. Once again, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, and let's build something cool together.
From Gabaletta, 260 million phones is insane. All I can think of is the huge potential e-waste, because we know Galaxy A1X series don't last longer than 2 years before consumers replace them with a newer device. And I really feel like it's going to be one of the ugliest parts of our industry and of our hobby. Because recently there was also just like another series of stories coming out about Chromebooks. The ultra inexpensive Chromebooks that we sell to schools and we sell to students, and this is a laptop for the elderly because it can barely load Chrome as a browser and it's so underpowered, but you can get it for like $300. Now, every time I show off one of my laptop docks, you know, it's an empty shell of a laptop, but you connect a phone or another computer and you use that. Everyone always says, "Oh, why wouldn't you just get a full computer?" Because the computer you can buy for $300 is going to last you 2 or 3 years of moderate use, and then it's garbage, and you can't do anything else with it. And that's bad. Why are we dumping this much? But we also then have to have those really hard conversations about how do we connect people that don't have the means to go out and buy more premium stuff. And we need a whole new set of consumer protection initiatives. We need a whole new series of right to repair initiatives. Like, Luis Rossman can't do all of right to repair on his own. It's like him and Hugh Jeffries. And then it's like, but they're right. We need something else. You've got like a really underpowered, what we need is like a framework? That's the name of the company, right? The Framework Laptop. What we need is an initiative to mandate that if you come out with a new laptop, you don't have to throw the whole laptop away to upgrade to a more powerful laptop. But that gets in the way of corporations, and that infringes on their rights to sell people low-cost garbage. It's rough. It's really rough. And especially when we get to things like an artificial software lock. Like, if you wanted to keep using Chrome OS past the 4 or 5 years of official support, it just shuts off and you don't get any other patches. And you're like, well, what changed in Chrome OS that was going to be a problem? Nothing. Chrome OS is still kind of the same, especially if you have like an older Core i5. Nothing would really keep you from running modern Chrome OS. We can install Chrome OS on ridiculously underpowered PCs, right? So, you know, it sucks. Dave Burns, Juan advocates for a planned economy. Yeah, I do. Actually, I do. I will be one who will say, like, if I ever have to run for any political office, one of my main campaign points is your business is not allowed to exist if you are not part of cleaning up your own mess. Great. You made this amazing product and it pollutes the environment like this. You need to be responsible for cleaning up that pollution. And if you're not, then your business isn't allowed to survive. Or you need to pay the government for cleaning up your mess. The entire lifestyle of your product has to be accounted for. I feel like that's fair now. You made this product. The consumer uses this product. The consumer's done with this product. What happens to it? You need to have an answer. And if you don't, well, then you didn't really flesh out your business model, did you? Because right now, my entire life, and for generations of consumers, company makes a product, It does a ton of pollution to the environment, and then taxpayers are on the hook for cleaning up after that company. And that's not fair. I feel like that one needs a rethink. All right, so quick subreddit plug. Every podcast, every live stream has a subreddit. Mine is no exception. Reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. Reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. And wouldn't you know it, top of the pile this week, A number one, is this doofus in a flat cap looking at the OnePlus pad. So I took the top place in my subreddit this week. My subreddit is not about me. Glowing Rectangles is a place to share content you feel deserves more attention. And so the number two story is a great video looking at the differences between the Oppo Find X Pro and the Vivo X90 Pro Plus from one Mr. Barry Johnson. He's taken the number two spot. And then number three. Now, I'm going to take credit for this because I submitted this video. So it's pretty much like I won again. It's pretty much like I'm always the winner, but I'm not always the winner of my own subreddit. That's not true. But this is from, what is this? Track and Tech English. Vivo and Leica explain real reasons why front camera 4K video doesn't exist on many flagships. But really, this is a sit-down conversation with a Vivo representative and a Leica representative going through the new X90 Pro, the X90 Pro Plus, all of the new updates to the V2 coprocessor, the camera app. And it's actually a really fun conversation as they kind of dig back and forth. Their reasoning on why front-facing selfie cameras from a lot of these Chinese and Indian phones only support 1080p is laughably bad. Their excuse for why you don't have 4K on a front-facing camera is terrifically awful. So I would highly recommend catching the video, catching this the interview and the conversation, just to hear them say, like, oh, but we did this because of these reasons. Yeah, we had reasons. And you're like, no, those are bad reasons. those are not the good reasons. Please support, contribute, participate. Reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. Sitting pretty at like 2,700 members and followers of the subreddit, and we're getting some great posts every week. So click those up arrows. Submit more content. Again, it's videos and articles and editorials that you feel, and podcasts that you feel, deserve more attention. And even if it's your own stuff, you are allowed to post your own stuff on reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. Okay. So I got this here from Farhan. This is the first comment out of the subreddit plug. Imagine Sony giving 4K 120 frame per second video for the front camera. Can't wait to see the comments explode like crazy. Yeah, it's the only thing. Like, you know, on an Xperia, which is part of this little live stream down here. Hello, everybody. This is an Xperia front-facing camera. Yeah, it's the only camera on the phone that doesn't shoot 4K 120. It'd be pretty sweet. Aditi is also saying, I think the Vivo V27 comes with 4K on the selfie, right? And not the X90 Pro. Correct. I have the Vivos. This is the V27 Pro. V27 Pro does 4K from the front. Here, let me fire this up right now. Oh, the battery might be about to die. I didn't charge it all weekend. Sorry, Vivo. Let me see if I can even get the camera to open without it crashing. Okay, and video. And yep. Right. Oh, you won't be able to see it from my camera over here. But 4K? 4K 60 from the front camera on the V27. We don't get 4K at all on the X90 Pro. The X90 Pro, demonstrably more powerful than the V27 Pro, which, let me get my little charger brick here. I gotta charge this V27. I still have to finish another video because I wanna talk about the regular V27 versus the V27 Pro. So yeah, that's, again, watch that video because it's hilarious, because even on Vivo's own products, they're like, yeah, we've got phones that can do that, but reasons why you can't do that on the X90 Pro and Pro Plus. Reasons. So,
Oh, man. Yeah, Gabaletta, completely agree. So Farhan is saying, so the Xperia is the one you use for your Instagram stream. I'm trying Instagram right now. This is the first time I've ever done a co-stream like this. But yeah, there is a little Instagram live feed that's going on right now with the podcast. And it is. It's on the Xperia 1 Mark IV. We've been streaming for an hour and 14 minutes, and it's doing great. It's all in battery power. So hopefully the battery will last another 50 minutes of streaming. So speaking of Xperias and Sonys that can do really cool live streaming and stuff and have reasonably high-quality front-facing selfie cameras now, who wants to talk about Xperia 1 Mark V? Yeah? Anyone? And Bueller? Bueller. So this came in, and this is from the official Sony Xperia YouTube channel. And I'm going to mute this just because it's probably going to have music or something. But, you know, you click on this and see the Xperia logo pop up and then some light streaks, lasers, and the next one is coming. And then you see this, like, sensor thing. That's pretty cool. And then we do like an aerial drone shot into a guy standing on top of a mountain, like Jedi style, but he doesn't have a lightsaber. No, he doesn't. What does he have? He has an Xperia. And then it's new product announcement, the 11th of May, 2023 in Japan. Oh boy, Sony logo and we're out. And that's our teaser. That's a pretty good teaser, right? So we're really excited about that. All of our questions answered. I mean, we're pretty much done. That's all we needed to know. Xperia 1 Mark V, right? It's pretty great. Is anyone here anxious? Because is anyone here looking forward to another Xperia? They are always high up on my list because they're the last feature complete phones that we can really vote with our wallets. And I'm hoping that that continues. I'm hoping that the Xperia 1 Mark IV got this really great controller accessory. They started adding the functionality of using the little portable vlogging display and the handle. There's an ecosystem of Sony camera hardware that is now compatible with the Xperia series. And I think if you change the Xperia 5 too much, like you change the design or you change the features too much, the Xperia 5 won't work with those accessories as well, and it kind of erodes the confidence in buying into the Sony ecosystem. I want to have a Sony Alpha or a Sony Z series camera, and then I also want to pair it with an Xperia because they all work together really well. But then if you remove features from an Xperia, it makes that a little less complete. So I'm honestly kind of hoping that the Xperia 1 Mark V is basically a 1 Mark IV, but with the new Snapdragon SoC. Like, if you could just swap out the 8 Gen 1 for the 8 Gen 2, and I got all the performance improvements and thermal performance improvements, and I could shoot video longer out in the field, like, that could be enough of an upgrade for me. That would be fine. But obviously, they're teasing something else, like a new camera experience. The new one is coming. They showed us an image of a sensor. So what do we think is gonna go down on an Xperia 1 Mark V? sorry, this is just backtracking here for a second. Gabaletta says, it would have been easier to say, the reason we don't do 4K 60 on the front camera is because of terrible front-facing cameras. Which I agree. Front-facing cameras are for, like, video calls and streams. If you create content, it's rear cameras all the way. Let's see. Farhan, if it was Samsung or Google, their upcoming new phone would have heavily leaked like crazy. So Wi-Fi is saying, I've always wished that the Sony phones were more accepted. I keep pointing people to them because, like I said, I've got my uncle who's got a Galaxy S9 and it started to die, so he replaced it with another Galaxy S9. He's on a Galaxy S9. He likes things like having that massive memory card in his phone and having a headphone jack. The only phone left to point him to would maybe be something like an Xperia 5. Like, that might be his upgrade path. And then there's nothing left. So I'm really anxious. Like, I wish I wish we had just a little bit more marketing from Sony. Just that any kind of North American conversation was being led more directly. But again, this is a very international phone problem to have. No company wants to come to the United States and drop hundreds of millions of dollars in marketing to convince a couple people to try the phone. And that's just not feasible. But what do we think? We know the Sony is, the Xperia 1 is going to be a premium priced product. I think the One Mark 4, it launched at like $1,599. Is that what the launch MSRP was? I mean, it had some price cuts and stuff, but this phone was an expensive phone to launch. From Wi-Fi, I've never held one, but reviews seem like the cameras are always on point. Wonder if it really is the old Android versus iPhone war that's at the heart of it. I really feel it's marketing Wi-Fi. I really feel it's whatever company spends the most on making consumers feel cool in North America, that's the phone that typically wins. It has almost nothing to do with the meritocracy of the gadget. And Sony cameras are phenomenally good. They are the most different you can get from an iPhone or a Pixel. And so if you don't educate the consumers on your own, then that creates a conversation vacuum. And in a conversation vacuum, then popularity wins, because YouTube creators need to make money, and they're going to make way more money telling iPhone owners they were clever to buy the iPhone and not the Sony, because look, the Sony is just different. And when I take two auto mode photos, look at the colors, and the colors aren't as good. And the Sony does bad colors, and they're not as HDR. And look at average consumers. And you're always going to lose. And it's the thing I was pushing LG in their dying days aggressively. I've had conversations with folks at Motorola. Like, if you don't get out there and lead part of this conversation, it's going to be filled. And it's going to be filled by people that have a vested interest in maintaining the status quo of how they make money on YouTube. And you only make money on YouTube if you just parrot and repeat whatever is the most popular. So, whew. Dave Burns, $1,500 for a zero compromise phone, 12 megapixel, 1-inch type sensor. Oh man. You know, from what we've seen leaked, I don't know that they'll go pro. So the Sony Pro I had a 1-inch type sensor that was kind of cropped, so that was more like a 1/1.3-inch type sensor. And it's the only Sony that has had a significantly different camera module arrangement. And if you change the camera module arrangement, it breaks the compatibility of some of those accessories. It won't fit as well in the same controllers and containers. And I'm hoping, I don't know that this is going to be what happens, but I'm hoping that you can maintain that. But if Sony's doing a new camera sensor, or if Sony is doing some kind of new equipment, I think it's likely it'll show up on a One Mark 5. So I don't know. If you could do 1-inch type sensor and also do 4K at 120 frames per second, that would be something that no other manufacturer can lay their hands on. That would be pretty intense. Farhan says it has new CMOS tech for low noise. Farhan, was it you that shared? Oh, yes. Yeah, okay. According to GSM, Farhan says, according to GSM Arena, the One Mark 5 will have an IMX858 sensor, and that's the sensor from Xiaomi 13 Ultra's ultra-wide and telephoto camera. I don't know. So the IMX 858 is like a 1/2.4-inch sensor, isn't it? Which would make it a lot smaller than the sensor that's on, it, not a lot smaller, but it would make it noticeably smaller than the sensor that's on the One Mark 4. The One Mark 4 has a 1/1.7-inch type sensor, IMX 858 specs. I just want to look this up and make sure I have this right. Oh, it's not a 1/2.4, it's a 1/2.5. So that would, if the Xperia 1 Mark 5 main camera sensor is the same as the companion sensors on the Xiaomi Ultra, I think that would be a downgrade. It would be a downgrade, and we don't know that those are, XMORE RS Exmor RS sensors are what are in the Sony Xperia 1 Mark IV, and that's why we get this insanely fast high readout. You know, this phone on the rear cameras, all three of them can shoot 4K at 120 frames per second. Even on the telescoping the telephoto sensor that actually has movable zoom elements, like you actually zoom. It's not just switching discrete focal lengths. McCorkran, man, Twitch streams do a number on phone battery. Let's see. What are we at? Can I get it? Hey, so my Xperia 1 Mark IV was charged to 90%, 92%, because I wanted to check this out. We've been streaming for an hour and 20 minutes, and it's down to 78%. That's pretty good. That's not bad. I'm really stoked about that. I mean, I was going to check at the end of the stream, but like, you know, for a phone that runs a little warm, thanks to the Snapdragon 8 Gen 1, that's pretty good. We could just keep going, and we haven't had any, thermal warnings or anything. I'm streaming over Wi-Fi. I bet you that would be way different if I were streaming over the 5G. Then I believe my phone battery would be tanking a lot harder. But yeah, 92 to 78. I'm good with that. That's real good. This made me happy. So again, if I could just get this phone, the Xperia 1 Mark IV, with a Snapdragon 8 Gen 2, and maybe you just kind of spruce up. Maybe this is a new sensor tech and it's the same size sensor. The advantage to a Sony is the AI is not used to make crazy HDR, night mode, night into day photos, anything like that. The AI is like, hey, there's a soccer player across the field and you've got this ridiculous telephoto zoom sensor. And not only can you shoot 4K at 120 frames per second, but when you zoom up on that guy's face, it's tracking his eyeball. It's like Skynet. It's like Terminator view AI face tracking. That's what a Sony is about. It is the best action, sports, track your kid and then also track Olympic athletes. Speed. It's all about speed. And if I could just get all of this speed, but I could run those cameras harder out in the field because they're not overheating, that's I'm good. That could be enough right there. And I'd still have the memory card slot, and I'd still have the headphone jack, and I'd still have the 4K display. I'd still have all the monitor features where you can plug this into a camera. Keep all of that, and then just give me the 8 Gen 2, and that would be rad. Especially if they could also kind of maybe that could minimize some of their production costs so the phone is more profitable, then the Sony division stays healthy. Like, all of that would just kind of get wrapped up together. Yeah, Farhan. I mean, I still have my Xperia 1 Mark II. Farhan says the Xperia 1 and 5 Mark II look like a tempting choice because of the Snapdragon 865. So the 1 Mark III had the Snapdragon 888. And I believe that ran a little warm, but it didn't have quite as vice-locked windows of video recording as the 1 Mark IV. I tend to lean to the 1 Mark IV just because all of the features are so much better. The screen is brighter, the video recording capabilities are incredible, the autofocus, the eye tracking, all of that got improved. But if you were just looking at how long can I run out in the field, then yeah, a Snapdragon 865 is going to do you better. But I just change my behavior. If I carry my 1 Mark IV and I'm out in the field, I just know I'm not going to be recording for hour-long video runs. I know I'm shooting 4K 120 in short bursts because I'm gonna time stretch that to 4K 30. So every second of footage I shoot is going to be 4 seconds of content to edit. So I just don't shoot long stretches of 4K 120. Let's see. Okay, I was just checking in on the little Instagram comments right there, but we're a little ways away before I can start jumping in on other things like music and other streaming apps. All right, let's see. McCorkran, if I had the disposable income, Sony would be on my short list of options for sure. Ooh, what's this? Simon says, Hypno, I got my mom in an OG Xperia 1 last year and she loved it, but the fingerprint sensor has given up the ghost and I ordered her a Pixel 7 as a surprise upgrade. You're a good son. That's a fun combo of phones to shift to. And I think I still have, I think I still have an original Xperia 1 over there. I was just kind of blown away by what Sony was doing on that phone. And then the Xperia 1 Mark II just got even better. Yeah, I've been real hype about what Sony's going to do. So I hope we see a solid launch. We're going to find out in 10 days, which is kind of a bummer because I'm going to go through next week's podcast and then the announcement's going to happen. And then we're going to have to wait like almost another week before I bring it up on the show again and confirm whatever is going to be happening on this new Xperia. But Sony just does not get the credit that they deserve. Advanced power management features, advanced camera control features. You can use it as the display for another camera. You just plug it in. It does a video input, especially if you've got like a little mini-sized HDMI adapter. It's just so good. And it really does feel like a pro phone for content creation. We call all these phones pros. Like I've got a V27 Pro. Like this is a mid-ranger pro phone. I don't know that it really helps me get my work done any better than any other phone. But then I pick up an Xperia or a Xiaomi. These ultra and pro experiences feel like, oh, this is for getting the work done. The Galaxy Note 23 feels like the top pro productivity phone. If I need to edit or do art or work through documents and spreadsheets or sign contracts, yeah, the stylus, the S Pen, that's what it is. So again, it's like we need to wrestle back, you know, some of those words. The word pro has basically just been overrun. From Treston, 2001, I've never had any thermal issues on my Xperia. So I do not call them thermal problems because Sony does something way better than any other phone manufacturer that launched a phone last year. My Xperia 1 Mark IV has the Snapdragon 8 Gen 1, and that chip runs warm. It is laptop-grade powerful, but it is power-thirsty, and it does not do a good job of handling thermal load. But when you pick up a Sony camera, you are picking up a device that is now under the umbrella of the Sony Alpha division, the Sony imaging division. So the camera department is mostly in charge of guiding their phone division. Excuse me. When you handle a Sony, it aggressively notifies you at the potential of your video quality starting to degrade. Very few other phones give you as specific a notification about the potential for your video starting to drop. When you shoot 4K 120 or even 4K 60, and you know a Sony in warm weather will not shoot video as long as like a OnePlus or a Samsung or an iPhone, when you go back to check that footage, Sony's have consistently been the best options for maintaining the exact frame rate that you told the phone you wanted to shoot at. So you say 4K 60, it shoots 4K 60. At as close to a perfect frame rate as it can until it starts to struggle, and then it notifies the user well before you're actually starting to degrade that video quality. On my Xiaomi 12S Ultra, the 12S Ultra, not the Xiaomi 13 Ultra, when I shot 4K 60 in a long video test, this phone lasted way longer than the Xperia. I think at the time I was testing the Xperia 5. So the Xperia 5 Mark IV versus my Xiaomi 12S Ultra. The Xperia, I think, tapped out after like 7 or 10 minutes of 4K 60. But the Xiaomi went for like 30 minutes, and it's like almost 90 degrees outside. Whoa, that's amazing. It shot 4K 60 for a half hour, and I never got a thermal warning, and it never shut off the clip. This phone must be so much better. And then I checked the footage and I dropped it into DaVinci Resolve. And before I even needed to look at the metadata of that footage, DaVinci Resolve said, "Do you want to change the frame rate of your project?" I'm like, well, why would I need to change the frame rate? My DaVinci Resolve timeline is 4K 60, and I told the phone to shoot 4K 60. What's up? So then I say, yeah, change the timeline. And it dropped to 4K 45. No one shoots video at 45 frames per second. The video clip saved was 4K at 45. It cut 25% of the frames that I told it to record. So I feel like that's a topic that doesn't get enough nuance, that Sony maintains a specific... The Sony will do what you tell it to do until it physically cannot do it any longer, but it warns you before you get to a point where it can't do what you told it to do. So, yeah, Farhan, 45 FPS, is that even a thing? No. No, it's not. Trustin, I knew it. I knew it cheated. But again, I mean, like, I've been showing that off for a while. Samsung's dropped frames like crazy. iPhones were way more consistent. They were. But they were never perfect. And I found so few phones that really do what the Sony does, even though the Sony is telling you about its limitations. I would rather a phone tell me its limitations than try and trick me, right? If a Samsung is about to start dropping frames, I wish it would just pop up like, hey, we've got to do this. Instead of getting to the point of thermal shutdown, let me know before the video is starting to degrade. And that's the difference between an all-rounder, you know, phone that does phone things for average consumers and a phone that you can really better rely on as a more professional tool. I don't know. I know this market is way smaller. Anyway, so I don't think it's going to be the IMX858, but I'm expecting to see some kind of announcement from Sony that there's something cool and new. But even if it's pretty close to the One Mark IV, I'm happy. Like, I'm really trying to rack my brain. Like, what would be a deal breaker for me on the One Mark V? And it would be if they lost really good professional features like SD card support and a headphone jack. And if Sony does that and they walk away from the flexibility of their platform to be used in better ways, then to me they become just another option in a sea of samey phones. And there's nothing special about an Xperia. Well, I shouldn't say nothing, but it's less special if an Xperia loses headphone jack and memory card. The Xperia One Mark IV has 512 gig of built-in storage, and I have a 512 gig card in the phone. And let me tell you, getting an overall terabyte of storage, not that expensive. I mean, even when the phone was like full MSRP, pretty good. Can't upgrade any other phone like that. Can't take your 512 gig Samsung and add storage to it. That's not a thing. Really sucks. Really sucks. Yeah, and Fungi just said the same thing. Also, the Xperia is way more value because I already have a 512 gig SD card. Yeah. Yeah. It's silly not to have it. No, let's get rid of SIM card trays because eSIM is going to be so better. And on the iPhone, you get no benefit for removing the SIM card tray. But eventually, we'll fill that space with other technologies. You know what? Maybe just keep a practical technology that adds a great consumer benefit. But, oh no, one time I had an SD card fail. Oh, you can't, they're so unreliable. Don't buy garbage SD cards. So, Sony Xperia, very excited to be seeing that on the horizon. Also, and again, this one is another, this week's podcast is pretty much brought to you by Ars Technica. Kevin Purdy wrote up a quick thing. Who wants to talk about Steam Deck killers? Yeah? So Kevin writes, I, for one, welcome our new Steam Deck killing Windows running overlords. How the Asus ROG Ally and other handheld PCs could make Steam Decks even better. And so we got the full scoop on the ROG Ally. Windows 11, it's running a new AMD Ryzen Z1 chip. We've got up to 16 gig of RAM, up to 512 gigs of storage. The storage is upgradable. Got a reasonable weight, 608 grams, a full HD 120 hertz display, accessories, dual speakers, ROG's intelligent cooling system. Again, that seems like an offshoot of how ROG handles laptop cooling. This is very interesting to me because I shot a video loosely saying that Steam Deck killers did not exist. At the time I'd shot that video, we had seen a push for very boutique manufacturers doing these one-off handheld systems, aggressively trying to fight the Steam Deck, but then you'd get something that was like 5 to 8% more powerful in gameplay, but then at like twice the price. Or it's only $200 more expensive than the most expensive Steam Deck, and you can get 10 frames per second in this one game if you turn some of these settings down. And like, that's not a Steam Deck killer. Just because something is more powerful doesn't mean it kills the Steam Deck. What you have is a Steam Deck competitor, and Steam Deck competitors are very exciting. But to kill the Steam Deck, you have to arrive at a price and a performance with the same level of customization, the same level of controls, the same level of accessories in the ecosystem, and for me, the same level of repairability, where you can get parts and pieces and correct things that as the system ages, you can replace. Well, if we look to some of the rumors, this ROG Ally, fully spec'd out, 16 gig of RAM and 512 gig of storage, could land somewhere around $700, which is only like 50 bucks more than the top of the line Steam Deck. ROG has already addressed one of my main issues, upgradable storage. So we know there is going to be some degree of opening the case and replacing components. I don't believe, like when we see pictures of this thing in action, I don't believe it's going to be as customizable as the Steam Deck, because we don't have, like, we've got the thumbsticks, we've got the triggers, we've got the buttons, but we don't have the trackpads. So there are going to be some games, like especially more sort of like older PC style games, where I use those trackpads quite a bit. So, whoops, I don't even have it. There we go. So we don't have the trackpads. The Steam Deck is going to take a win for some of the versatility in how you can program the gaming experience for certain PC titles. That is not a huge selling point, but it is something to consider. And $50 difference. I have to believe Asus is going to have a better infrastructure for service, for repairability, for warranty than any of the boutique Steam Deck killers out there. I have to believe, given Asus's very high track record of support and maintenance on their ROG equipment, that Asus takes the ROG label very seriously for their high-end gaming equipment. And if they put the ROG label on a phone, or if they put it on one of these portables, I believe, to me, that inspires a lot more confidence than a Kickstarter product that from a company I've never heard of before. I trust that ROG label more than I would trust a Kickstarter. This could be close. This could be really close. Because if you can keep the tiers of storage to close to the pricing on the Steam Deck, and maybe we're talking $50 or maybe even $100 premium. So like, let's say you've got a 256 gig Steam Deck versus a 256 gig ROG Ally, and it's like a $75 price point. The performance of a new chip could be enough. The screen resolution and refresh rate could be enough to convince someone to bump up. Now, we've got 120 hertz. I have many phones with 120 hertz refresh rate displays, and very few games that really do play out at 120 hertz. I often have to go to something like my Red Magic. So my Red Magic will play Undead Horde and Neon Chrome and Dead Cells. You see those games, like you got Dead Cells and it's a precision platforming roguelite. Yeah, 120 hertz makes a difference there. I have the case on my Red Magic on backwards. 120 hertz for a precision platformer looks great. I play Dead Cells on this phone. I don't play Dead Cells on my Steam Deck because I don't like going down to 60 FPS. it doesn't look as good. And the timing and the precision on jumps matters enough. I go to the phone to play that game. So for some of these titles, 120 hertz on the ROG Ally makes sense. But something tells me on a portable system with a little battery that has to power an even higher resolution and a thirstier screen, you're not going to be playing, you know, Monster Hunter at 120 hertz. You're not going to be playing any new AAA games at, you know, like Elden Ring. It's not going to hit 120 hertz unless you really tank the graphics quality on all that. So from Osman, yeah, not going to lie, Asus does have a good track record of making top-tier gaming equipment. ROG is a label you take seriously. I've done so much work with Asus over the years, especially while I was at Newegg. And you know what? They've got representatives, they've got marketing, they've got people. When you talk to their engineers and when you talk to their reps, like, they are so passionate about that PC building and DIY community. And like, this is the motherboard and we listened to this feedback and we incorporated this and we heard your concerns and thermals and how you do that and these capacitors and these caps. And you're like, yeah, yeah, you see them directly interacting with their core user base in a way that not all companies can really match. And so if they put the ROG label on this, I feel like there's some trust there. Does it mean I'm going to toss my Steam Deck out the window? No. One of the other things I kind of like, I haven't installed Windows on my Steam Deck. I'm playing games through a few games through the Epic Game Store, a few games through good old games. I've bought a lot more games on Steam since buying the Steam Deck, so the Steam Deck's mission totally worked. But again, I also had a huge library of like Humble Bundle and Fanatical and like just tons and tons and tons of games that I've barely even cracked into. I kind of like not having to interact with Windows. I know you can pick up your ROG Ally and you launch Windows, and then you can go into whatever launcher you want. You want to play an Epic game or a Steam game or a GOG game, great. But I really like not having that step of interacting with another operating system to then get into a game launcher to then launch my game. Or interacting with Windows to then click on a shortcut on my Windows desktop to then launch a game. I really like the more console-like approach of SteamOS. So even though this is launching with Windows 11, I hope some intrepid software hackers and tweakers will pick this up and then go, yeah, but we could just nuke all the Windows stuff and put on SteamOS. That would make me even more interested in this. Like, it runs Linux if you want it to. You can tinker, you can install emulators, you can do all that fun stuff. Or you can just pin a browser to launch Game Pass if you want to do some game streaming. I've not been hurting for Windows. I really haven't. And I don't like the overhead of a full desktop computer-grade operating system for something that's really going to be focused on gaming. And then if I need to do other kind of computery things on it, Linux has been phenomenal. Most of the apps and programs that I would really need to interact with, I can still do on Linux. I haven't needed Windows on a smaller, more power-efficient platform like this. So, yeah, $700. That's insane. That's crazy pants. Whew. Oh, hey, Ultra Ego. Thanks for jumping in. I appreciate that. So, Grounded Tech, I'm late, but good evening to you, Juan and chat. So, is that going to wrap us up? It is. That's all my links. I'm going to take another drink of coffee here and just kind of hope my voice... questions. Where do we go from here? Do we want to talk Xiaomi 13 Ultra, or do we want to talk about the OnePlus Pad? We can talk about the OnePlus Pad. I was just drawn into another conversation on Reddit where people were like, oh, it's got like the worst screen ever. I didn't even know they made screens this bad anymore because I only have the bestest OLEDs on my sub $500 tablets. So I'm going to drink this coffee and you let me know. Where are we going? OP Pad or Xiaomi 13 Ultra? Ready, break.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people. producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Hey there, Juan, and hey there, you. This is Jason Howell from All About Android over at the twit.tv podcast network. Juan has been a guest on All About Android a number of times. In fact, we have awesome guests on the show each and every week, and we'd love for you to check out the show if you haven't already. Twit.tv/AAA is where you can go to find new episodes of All About Android. Each and every week, we talk about the top Android news, hardware, apps. We have a reviews portion called The Arena. It's very competitive, but in a fun way. We have a really great time doing this show, and we would love for you to join us sometime and check it out. We get journalists from throughout the Android world joining us. We even sometimes get Googlers who are actually making Android on the show to talk about what we love so much about the world of Android. That's twit.tv/AAA for new episodes of All About Android each and every Tuesday. All right, Juan, back to you.
Sorry, I didn't click my mic back on. Dave Byrne saying that's a really unfair choice, Juan. And Aditya, do OnePlus still make tablets? So Barry saying, Grounded Tech is saying Xiaomi. Barry saying Golan. Barry wants me to talk about Golan. What's up, Golan? I think Awesome Possum is trying to correct my pronunciation of Xiaomi. Xiaomi. Is it Xiao or Chow? Osman saying let's go OnePlus Pad. Actually, we've had a few more saying OnePlus. So let's go OnePlus Pad. This is the OnePlus Pad. You know what? Hold on one second. I'm going to make one quick little camera adjustment and just kind of open that up. So on this camera over here, I've got like auto framing and it gets really weird. But unfortunately for folks here on the Instagram, you're sort of phone, selfie phone view. So when I hold up a tablet, it's going to like fill the sides there. So this is the OnePlus Pad. I very much like this OnePlus Pad. This is in the keyboard case with the stylus, the OnePlus stylus pen thing, and it's got a little magnetic attachment. I think this is the most elegant kind of combination of accessories. My camera's not going to focus. The Xperia is doing a better job of focusing than my Panasonic, by the way. I'm not plugging my Instagram version of this feed, but I'm just saying when I do something like that and it focuses better, like you can kind of see the product better than on my really expensive mirrorless camera with a lens that's almost the price of this phone. Good job, Sony Xperia selfie camera. It's pretty great. OnePlus Pad. All the specs have already been out. We've already heard that. What blew us away, and last week we talked about the Pad. I had this tablet, right? I was under embargo. Couldn't talk about the tablet. This is the reality of being a tech reviewer, right? I often have things on my desk that I can't show you just yet until the company says the embargo has lifted. But the thing that they had not told us was the price. So I go through this spiel because I'm expecting a much higher price. I really thought in my brain this tablet was going to launch at $549. For some reason, that's the number that was in my brain. And so if you go back a podcast or two, I'm talking like, yeah, and you know, all the tech that we have in here and what this thing can do, TK got to hold one of the prototypes at like a trade show and he really thought it was beautifully built. Like all these things, you know, like, I mean, it's a really nicely built tablet. So I was willing to even consider this could launch as high as $599. And I say that in my podcast. And then literally like the day after... going through that, OnePlus is like, no, we're going to sell it for $479. Like, okay, I was off by $70 or $80. I did not predict that well. So the OnePlus Pad, just the tablet by itself. So let me just kind of pull this out here and pull it out of the keyboard case. And this is just the, oh, and the pen. So just this right here is $479. And, it has one of the worst screens that's ever been put onto anything ever. Here, let me unlock it. I haven't done it in a few days. Okay. So you can totally tell by all the pixels that this screen is terrible because it's an LCD. You know, LCDs have never been gooder enough, and everything should have OLEDs. So it doesn't matter that this is beautifully constructed, has one of the most powerful SoCs on the market today. This outpaces all of the Galaxy Tab S8s. The Dimensity 9000 is neck and neck with like a Snapdragon 8 Plus Gen 1, not only in performance, but also performance per watt. So this is one of the most powerful portable computer solutions available today. And it's like $150 less than a Galaxy Tab S8 Plus, right? And the screen is hot garbage. You know, you could never, I mean, even just using this 120 hertz LCD with incredible viewing angles and really good color saturation, I've turned it down just to the more authentic mode, you know, the not super hyped color mode. So like here, I'm even showing it like way off axis and on camera, like that's pretty good. You're not seeing any color shift on that LCD at that angle. Like, you know, where it's really reflecting my face as much as you'd actually be able to see the screen, you know. So we can say, oh, LCD not as good as OLED, and my personal preference is OLED. I would prefer more products have OLEDs, but to sit here and try and act like just because it's an LCD it's somehow garbage is hack. That's a really hacky thing to whine about on a sub $500 tablet. I want to show, do I still have it down here? Oh, I don't know if this is even on or if it's even charged. I keep letting the battery on this die. Let's see. Hold on. Let me see. So this is a $400 Verizon 5G tablet. Let me see if it'll, can we all see like how badly that kind of chops? It's like 60 hertz. $400, significantly less powerful. Now, the OnePlus Pad does not have Verizon radios and antennas in there, but here, let me pull up something that's just a little more contrasty. Oh, I don't even think I have screen rotation on. Let's see. I'm doing it live. This is great. I didn't even do this in my video. Man, this UI is so slow. So, like, as soon as you kind of tip it, oh man, my camera's not really focusing. As soon as you kind of tip it, you can kind of see like how much you lose in the view. If I'm comparing this 60 hertz tablet with, I think it has a Snapdragon 480 in it, and then I'm comparing this tablet, which is $80 more, I don't know that we would call these the same species. I think they would be recognized as completely different evolutionary branches of the tree of life. But again, someone had to get their feelings up in a mess and say, oh, I didn't even know they could make screens this bad. Oh, it's so terrible. The screen's pretty. It would be prettier if it were the deep, contrasty look of an OLED. But it's really good. Like, I don't know what else to kind of say or how else to kind of compare. I don't know of another $500 tablet that is anywhere near the performance, the audio quality, the quad speakers, the capabilities, the flexibility, is up to date on software, bring some interesting little UI tweaks. They won't be for everybody, but like the way that you float and drag windows around, it's pretty good. It's not desktop mode good. And if you really want Dex, you should go with Dex. But this is way better than any other comparable tablet in Android land. I don't know of another competitor, especially one sold in North America, that you wouldn't have to import. Don't import a tablet. Don't do that. I'm good. So I don't really get, you know, because we kind of just get stuck in this echo chamber. Like there's this knee-jerk reaction like, oh, well, I like the OLED, so the OLED is the only thing that can be good for me. And I mean, I kind of understand, like, you get used to a certain feature and the way that it performs, but where you would really use this and where it would be most practical to use this as kind of a laptop replacement, you know, OLED has been slow to adopt in laptops. OLED has been slow to adopt in portable displays. I only, out of all of the portable monitors I have one portable OLED. And if you use a more expensive screen technology with support for high refresh rate, you've got to make other compromises on things like like the SoC. So the Lenovo, people brought that up. Well, I mean, you can buy that Lenovo for $300. Correct. The Lenovo P11 Gen 2 has an OLED, has a less powerful SoC. It's two generations of performance less than this. And I don't know about y'all, but I don't know what Lenovo's software and support conversation is going to look like. This OnePlus Pad has been promised to have, it's upside down. This OnePlus Pad has been promised to have 3 operating system updates and 4 years of security patches. I don't think any of my lower cost Lenovo tablets have ever touched that. So you're paying some money for that. We usually look at like comparable hardware and say that extended software support is between $100 and $150 feature, right? So you could cut $100 off of this and get less software and a prettier screen. I think that's a fair fight, but I don't think you can say one is demonstrably the winner just because LCD versus OLED. I've really liked this tablet. I mean, like, it really makes a strong argument for displacing a Chromebook. And it could step up. I think it could do a really good job of stepping up to replace, a small form factor Windows tablet. So being able to kind of put all of this together, it's not quite as flexible or as functional. It doesn't sit on your lap as well as using a proper laptop, notebook, computer. But your entire compute platform here is real little. So in that same way that we make fun of those iPad commercials, what's a computer? This could do it. This could be there. Add in active pen support. You know, like, I think these are now the new table stakes for the premium tablet experience, is being able to make them more functional and flexible in a way that could replace a Chromebook or a laptop. And if you try to compare this against a sub $500 Chromebook, this thing is going to destroy a sub $500 Chromebook using Android apps. The browser is going to be a little nicer on that sub $500 Chromebook, but it will not be close. You try to do something like edit 4K video, even up to like an Intel Core i5, like my Pixelbook Go. This thing is going to take performance wins when the software is properly optimized for that kind of mobile SoC. All right, McCorcoran, no, it does not. And this bugs me like crazy. Does the hinge allow you to use it as a bunch of different angles like the Surface Pro? There's no hinge. No. So the difference between this keyboard and a Surface Pro keyboard is, I'm trying not to drop it. So the pogo pins on the keyboard lock in one specific... Let me put this stylus down. I'm trying to do this. I should have set up B-cam. The flexible material here does something that a Surface Pro keyboard doesn't do well. So the magnetic attachment is not on the bottom of the tablet. It's on the back of the tablet. So you can wrap the keyboard all the way around behind, and it's not connected, so it's not interacting with the trackpad or the keys, and you can hold it just tablet style. The idea with the Surface is that you just disconnect it from the keyboard dock. That makes sense in a more sort of desktop style use. Like, hey, I'm using it at home and I want to carry this over to the kitchen, and I just pull it off the keyboard and I walk over and the hinge is built into the tablet, so I can set it down in the kitchen and then I can pick it back up and attach it to my keyboard. Here, the keyboard is only available to seat at one angle for the tablet. But it means that the keyboard doesn't need to be disconnected from the tablet as often when you want to go just screen. 6 of 1, half a dozen of another. They're very different approaches to kind of the same solution, but a Surface is going to be a lot, literally, pun intended, is going to be a lot more flexible because the hinge is built into the tablet. The OnePlus Pad is going to be a lot thinner because it doesn't have a hinge and all of the other supporting apparatus built into the hardware of the tablet. So you've got to kind of plan for, where do I think I'm going to be using this stuff the most. Sorry, I'm way behind. So Farhan saying, I haven't seen a new OLED laptop lately. Someone else just announced one. Was it Dell? Might have been an Alienware. I can't remember. My brain is Swiss cheese. It would be interesting to see a comparison with the Lenovo Duet 5 or something. OnePlus has the more powerful chip, but the Duet 5 comes with the keyboard and has OLED. Again, I think that is a very fun and very fair fight. I feel someone can make a purchasing decision or a purchasing recommendation. Do I want the inkier contrast? I still have the same high refresh rate. Or do I want the more powerful solution? And I think that's a good fight. And again, we're talking about sub $500. That is a great fight to have, sub $500. So, I mean, yeah, Corcoran, I think that's why. Farhan saying also the Duet 5 runs Chrome OS. I'm also planning just a quick, it's not going to be like an in-depth heavy hitting, but I have it downstairs. I also have the the Microsoft Surface Laptop Go 2, right? That's like, you can kind of find them for around $500 or $600, depending on how savvy a shopper you are. The version I have, I think, originally sold for like $7, but has dropped in price. 128 gigabyte SSD, 128 gigs of storage online. A little Intel Core i5 versus a Dimensity 9000. Like, what we would sell to a student for a student-grade laptop versus a tablet, I think that's kind of a fun fight. The Laptop Go 2 is kind of the most premium version of a Windows-powered student laptop, right? It's one of the most, it's so nicely built. It feels so much nicer than a cheap Chromebook or even a cheap Windows laptop. But you are making compromises on things like backlit keyboard, screen resolution, screen refresh rate, all of those things. Like, this tablet actually does better for cheaper. So I'm trying to put that together in my brain too. And I think Chrome OS absolutely is also that same kind of fun comparison point. Like, wherever you might complain about this OnePlus pad, I think you have to wildly misrepresent the price to performance. Oh, it's got an LCD and that's garbage. I have another tablet that's more expensive and it has a nicer screen. You should buy that one. You have to go out of your way to like move the goalposts around instead of saying, hey, this is like oranges to oranges. Like, what other sub $500 tablet is anywhere near this? And the Lenovo's close. And then you have to go to Chrome. You have to go to Chrome OS. You have to go to like that Duet. Golan is asking, does the ecosystem work good with the OnePlus 11? Unfortunately, that's still something we haven't gotten updated. And I think it won't really update until the tablet is properly shipping to consumers. I would recommend you check out my buddy TK Bay, who was able to get some of these features working on his Color OS phones. But you pick up, where's my OnePlus 11? I have way too many phones on my desk, guys, and I have to be really careful because if I move something around and I pick something up, I could like break an embargo, which would make for great podcasting, but would be real bad for my channel. OnePlus 11 is supposed to like auto connect, and then you can move apps over to the tablet, and you can share your phone's data connection. You can tether it. That feature isn't working directly right now, so I'm waiting on an update. I think both the OnePlus 11 and the tablet need an update before that works, but TK was able to get it working on Color OS devices. So you can check out his coverage for that feature, and it looks really cool. The OnePlus Buds have been awesome. So these are some of the best earbuds launched this year. You can tell OnePlus was really looking at the AirPods Pro 2, matching so many of the features, I think besting them in terms of audio quality, going dual driver. I really like what you can do to tune a dual driver earbud, and matching them for like the incredible noise canceling performance with spatial head tracking and support for LHDC for even higher quality audio streams. Multipoint has been awesome. So they're connected to my OnePlus 11. They're connected to my OnePlus Pad. Transfer them back and forth. It's so nice. So like now we're looking at premium tier earbuds. You know, you've got AirPods Pro 2 for OnePlus devices, and they just popped up. Your saved device is available. And now my Sony is saying, do you want to connect to the OnePlus Buds Pro? OnePlus Buds Pro 2. So good. Really, really good. And again, we want to talk about ecosystem. A lot of these benefits are still available on other Android phones. I haven't found anything that is feature locked or feature specific to OnePlus. So unlike Galaxy Buds, where the highest quality audio stream is locked to Galaxy phones, if your phone supports LHDC, which more phones are now supporting, especially Xiaomi devices do a really good job of supporting this, like $50 to $80 less than AirPods Pro 2 for about the same perks and the same performance and winning some of those performance battles over the AirPods Pro 2, that is fantastic buy. It's a great buy. So as an ecosystem, really the thing that OnePlus dropped the ball on was the watch. Well, let me take a drink of water here. Hold on. Ooh, I almost dropped my water all over my keyboard. Again, would have been great for the show, but terrible for my production. Yeah, I really like all of these products you're mentioning. These 2-in-1 tablets at reasonable prices for Windows, Android, Chrome OS. This stuff is right up my wheelhouse. I mean, it's really fun stuff. And I don't want a discount. Like, you could get a portable monitor or a laptop dock or even a wearable display and then plug in your phone. I mean, there is an argument to be made for, I have a tablet that does tablet things, and I have a phone that does phone things, and a computer that does computer things. Or you could pick up my Moto's way over there. You could pick up a Moto with Ready 4 and have all of those computers in one device. That's what's exciting to me, is we have very specific competitive alternatives, and that it's not just a one-size-fits-all solution. LFA reviews. Did someone say OnePlus Buds Pro 2? The spatial audio is locked to OnePlus. Oh, I thought that was opened up. Okay, so mea culpa. Apparently, spatial audio is locked, but I'll play with that too. Other than that, I guess everything else. So, if you're worried about audio fidelity, it's not like the Samsung argument where the highest quality codec is locked to only Samsung phones. For the OnePlus Buds, the spatial head tracking is locked to OnePlus devices. I'd have to check out, because I don't remember what you install on another phone now. Oh, yeah, McCorcoran, of course I do. Juan, do you remember the first tablet with a detachable keyboard you ever tried? Was it some kind of a Surface Pro or something? No, it was an Asus. It was the Asus Transformer. I was desperate to hold on to that thing. Asus sent it over. I was working at another tech outlet, a little tech blog that I don't even know if they're still around anymore. And they sent out an Asus Transformer, and ever since then, I've been on this radical mission. Technically, the first device that I bought a purpose-built, branded keyboard was the iPac. I can't remember which model it was. Was it 39? I think it might have been an iPac 3900, 3950, something like that. And you had this folding Compaq, C-O-M-P-A-Q, the company Compaq, and it had this little folding tray, and it popped out with that weird dock connector that was on the bottom of the iPac. You plugged it in, and you had a full keyboard, and I loved Windows Mobile. I adored Windows Mobile. So that was technically one of the first, like, true blue mobile, replace my laptop computer experiences, but the first proper larger screened tablet that I really owned and played with was the Asus Transformer. I was working at a just-in-time reseller, a JIT organization that worked with the Department of Energy, and I got to play with the Transmeta powered, what was it? It was the Compaq TC1100? I think that's what it was. And that was a Windows XP slate And it had its own like swivel, like kind of swivel out keyboard dock. So you could swivel the phone, the tablet into landscape or portrait. I provisioned a bunch of those and I sold a bunch of those to Department of Energy facilities, but I didn't really get to use them. So the first one that I really used in earnest was the ASUS Transformer. It was really good. It made me so sad when we lost that thread of experimentation on transformers and phone pads and pad phones. Those were some of the most some of the most exciting Android devices around. I can combine two things. I could legitimately use this as like a netbook replacement and as a tablet, or I could use this as a phone and a tablet replacement. Like, we've lost that adventure and we've lost that sense of spirit. Gormlord, I've never tried spatial audio. Is it gimmicky or is it actually something cool? I really like head tracking. I don't like just spatial audio. So imagine you're sitting, like I'm sitting here and this is like a movie theater, right? If I'm sitting in a movie theater and I've got really cool surround sound, there is a point of focus. That is the screen. My eyes are looking at the screen. And whatever's happening on the screen, I'm getting acoustic information from surround sound speakers. And as I move my head within that field of sound, the speaker orientation does not change. I am surrounded by audio, but I have context to where that audio is coming from, and I have an anchor point. I feel spatial audio without head tracking sounds super fake because you've got all of the surround sound, and then when you move your head, the speakers move with your head. And that is not how sound works out in your environment. That is not how sound works in a really good surround sound system. That's not how sound works for a really good movie theater experience. So to me, it immediately sounds fake. It immediately gives up the problem of spatial audio. As soon as you add head tracking and you set a focal point, I think this sounds so much more realistic. So if I'm watching a movie on a phone or a tablet and I've got spatial audio in my little earbuds and I set the tablet down in the kitchen and I move my head, I have a focal point. I have a focus point, an anchor point where I know that audio is coming from. And as I move around, it kind of follows to where that, I always have kind of an organic, this is where I look back to see the video that I'm looking at. For gaming, I've got the Audigy Mobius up in that book cubby right there. Even if you're, so I'm looking at a big widescreen monitor and I would put on the Odyssey, and they have really good head tracking. And so even when I'm just kind of looking it around at my super ultra wide monitor, those little movements are repositioning speakers and audio information in space as if I were sitting in that movie theater. So even subtle little movements are contributing to the illusion of surround sound audio. That to me is so much better than just spatial audio, but it stays locked to your head. For me, like that is a benefit. To me, head tracking makes spatial audio. A lot of people disagree with me. Yeah, exactly. So Aditya Anil, if there's a cello on your right, it would sound farther away if you turn your head to the left. That is how sound works. That is a very brief summation of my entire rambling explanation. From Gormlord, so you can hear where your phone is or the actual media is affected. I'm not sure I understand the distinction on that question. It doesn't do distance. We don't have distance in head tracking. So if I set up my tablet across the room and then I walk downstairs, it's not like I suddenly can't hear the tablet because I'm downstairs. So it doesn't do distance. That could be kind of interesting if like I set up the phone and I have surround sound and head tracking and then I walk across the kitchen and it sounds like it's distantly away at the angle. That could be kind of cool. Probably not that much better for the experience, but so you can hear where your phone is or the actual media is affected. Yes to both, kind of, but not really. I don't know. I'm not entirely sure how to expand on that. All right. So OnePlus Pad, I've had very positive experiences with it so far, and I'm looking at doing a comparison with my Razer Edge. So this is my Razer Edge gaming gaming tablet. This is a $399 starting price for a gaming-focused experience versus a $479 experience for a general-purpose computer experience. And then I'm also going to be doing a quick showdown with a student-grade laptop. So I'm looking at the Microsoft Surface Laptop Go 2. So those videos should be coming to the public YouTube channel over the next, probably over the next 2 weeks. Why don't we shift gears? You know, because we can talk about this till I'm blue in the face, and I want to spend like my podcast runs for 2 hours. I've now just started planning for around 2.5 hours, and now we're getting into the last 15 minutes. So we use the last 15 minutes here to talk about some early experiences on the Xiaomi 13 Ultra. I realized I was just kind of recycling what I was saying about the OnePlus Pad. I've got a video out. You can catch that first video just as a quick look, my first experiences using the tablet, digging into some of the nuts and bolts of reviewing it. And then I'm also going to have on the Patreon a performance post about the Xiaomi 13 Ultra and the OnePlus Pad together. So be on the lookout. That should be either tomorrow or Wednesday. But we've got the Xiaomi 13 Ultra. I'm going to take off the black case so you can see the pretty green underneath. And this is already high on the list for my favorite phone of the year. This thing is a stunning application of bleeding edge camera hardware and software. We've never seen anything like it. And it manages to create this level of excitement on top of where I was already crazy excited about last year's Xiaomi 12S Ultra. This is incredibly rare for me that I was this stoked for a phone last year, and then just as or more excited for the follow-up the next year. Increasingly, we look at a one-year upgrade, and it's not that big a deal. This is a pretty substantial evolution of the same idea. If you have a Xiaomi 12S Ultra, you still have one of the most monstrous photography solutions in your pocket today, and then the Xiaomi 13 Ultra just takes all of that a step further. Someone left me a really snarky comment like, oh, I guess you don't have a Galaxy S23 Ultra to compare it against. And you're like, because it's not really much of a comparison. If we're talking about photography and camera equipment, the Note 23 is good. It's very good. The Xiaomi 13 Ultra is a completely different beast. It really is fundamentally different than what Samsung has been coasting on, where the Note 23 feels a lot like the Note 22, which feels like an evolution, an iterative update over the S21 Ultra. We haven't really pushed the boundaries on Samsung cameras to any great degree over four generations of phones. And if we look at the Mi 11 to the 13 Ultra, we see radical adoption of technology and incredible application of software. So, I had to leave the snarky retort because it's not a comparison. It's not a fight. The Note 23, very good. You have very good cameras on that phone. You should be very happy with those phone cameras. If you're telling me you want the absolute best pocketable photography content creation solution today, you got to look at the 1-inch camera phones. You've got to look at the Vivo X90 Pro and the Pro Plus. You've got to look at the Oppo Find X Pro. And you've got to look at the Xiaomi 13 Pro and Xiaomi 13 Ultra. And all of them take wins and important philosophical differences above what Samsung and Apple are doing in North America. We're now 2 years behind. Unless Apple shocks us with a 1-inch camera sensor phone, which is probably not going to happen, the United States is 2 years behind the rest of the world for the exciting trend in smartphone photography. So I took the Xiaomi 13 Ultra down to the beach. It is remarkably good at catching action. It you have an HDR processing after effect. You push the shutter button, and if you're in really bright conditions or really high contrast conditions, you see that processing. It's similar to a Pixel 7 Pro or a Galaxy Note 23. You get the image, and you can see in the preview that it's still working on it, and then the image kind of pops, and you see all the finishing. So you definitely contend with that. Xiaomi has included a phenomenal buffer on this phone that is almost but not quite Sony good. So Lex is down at the beach, and I can't really screen share this because I don't share photos of Lex publicly on social media. But in a way that I would never have been able to, and I don't even know if I'll be able to get the exposure because the screen is so bright. The screen is really bright. I don't know if y'all knew this about, yeah, okay, you can kind of see that. So Lex at the beach, it's bright, so I get to work with a really fast shutter, but that's not enough. If you hit the shutter too many times, a lot of phones will start to buffer up photos, and then it works to process those photos, and then you eventually gray out the buffer and you can't keep shooting. A Pixel 7 does this after about 6 shots. A Vivo will do it after about 12, but it can chew through those photos really quickly. It doesn't slow you down as bad as a Pixel. I can't remember on the Samsung. I think it'll buffer pretty well. But what the Xiaomi was doing was just incredible. She's running full clip. This is from one of the telephoto sensors. And I'm just going pop, 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 pop. And it is not slowing down. It was cool at the beach, so it wasn't like a thermal issue or a processing issue. But I want to run through those again. So this is from the main wide camera. Then I went to the 5x telephoto, which is even more processing for having a smaller sensor at a longer focal length, and it's just pop, 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 pop. It's tracking her. All of these photos are sharp. All of these photos are in focus. She's running away from and towards the camera. It is not slowing down to keep up with her. It is nailing every single shot. The only other phone I've seen anything like that from, in terms of capturing kids at full speed and pets, the only phone that does it better is a Sony, is an Xperia 1 Mark IV. And I'm hoping we see, I'm very confident we'll see that kind of performance on the 1 Mark V.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to SomeGadgetGuy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
I've never seen anything that razor sharp on another phone player, especially where this phone is doing way more computational processing than a Sony will. I always felt like one of the reasons why a Sony can kind of keep up with that kind of shutter action and that kind of burst rate is because their photos are processed very camera-like. They're not doing a whole bunch of AI filtering and processing and HDR and all that mess. So you hit the shutter and it's just a very one-to-one capture, raw file, process the JPEG, spit it out of the queue. Raw file, JPEG, spit it out of the queue. This feels way more like it's doing that HDR stack, and it's processing, and it's keeping up with that immediacy of shutter action, which is a very different feel than what I'm used to on any other phone. like I said, even a Pixel, really good at capturing a moment. You don't get a lot of second chances. A Vivo, way better at processing HDR, and you feel like you can run a bunch of photos. Your kid's running around and it's Halloween and it's kind of dark, it's dim, it's dusk, they're in crazy costumes, and you get the autofocus, it's locked on your face, and you get a couple tries. You know, you get a couple tries to get that photo. They're mostly just motion blur at night. The Xiaomi was just nailing it. So I was very impressed with that. The 4K video is phenomenal. We were at the beach. I've got a bunch of these like little clips because I couldn't land. I was standing out at the beach like a total rube, like trying to shoot video of people surfing. And I kept missing like people really getting a good wave, a good curl, like all the way back to the beach. So I've got a lot of these little like 5 and 6 second clips of like surfers kind of hitting the water. And like, I think this is one of the best, and it's a boogie board. Just kind of like coasting all the way in, and the wave overtakes them. So I got a lot of stuff like that you're going to see. The ultra wide performance has been solid. I'm sorry that this is so difficult to kind of show on camera, but we saw this little ladybug. I'm going to share this on the Flickr because it's this adorable little ladybug on a piece of driftwood with the beach in the background. And just like, that's a stunning image. And I mean, it's not a macro shot. It's not like close up on the ladybug because I wanted to get the driftwood in the beach. But you can just see, like, this is already at a 2x zoom, and then you can zoom way in, and the ladybug is crazy sharp and crisp. And so this is like, this would be like the equivalent of a 5x zoom crop from that main camera sensor. And it's absolutely not something you can do on a Pixel, absolutely not something you can do on a Samsung. This photo's already been processed. This is not a raw file. This is not any other image manipulation or AI processing or anything. HDR photo's done. It was already at a 2x zoom to get this, and then you can get up that close on the ladybug, and that could be its own photo right there. That's the fundamental difference, the pixel-level detail advantage of going to a 1-inch type sensor. The pixels binned on this phone are bigger than the pixels on a Panasonic Lumix GH6 professional grade mirrorless camera. The sensor level performance is nipping at the heels of Micro Four Thirds cameras. And you see it on display every single time you take a photo. So then you add a variable aperture. It's just blowing my mind. Stopping down to f4, and it gives you that little bit of extra sharpness. It's about 2 stops different from the main wide open aperture. It's not revolutionary. It is not. It is not a radical difference going from f1.8 to f4 on a phone sensor. But you do a little pixel peeping, or you do a 2x zoom, a 2x crop, and F4 is just so crazy sharp. You lose those last kind of vestiges of fringing and flaring at the borders and edges of your subjects. You lose kind of some of that hazy effect just before objects start falling out of focus. It's just so crisp, and it's just so immediate. And the only thing that's kind of a bummer is I hate the way that Xiaomi does the menu on the aperture, because it's like 3 steps to get it to switch aperture. So if you're lining up your shot, here, let me get into the camera and let me get into photos. I might even be able to show this. So if you're lining up your shot, here's a really great photo of my armpit, and I'm trying to do this mirror image. Come on. You have to pull up this menu. So you pull up this menu, and then you tap the aperture menu, and then you get the ability to toggle the aperture, and you can go auto. Don't go auto. Don't let the phone decide. You pick. And so then you say, hey, I want F4. But the menu stays in place. So then you have to tap on your screen again. That entire process, if you're trying to compare F1.9 to F4, you have moved the phone too much to get the same exact field of view. And then you have to retap to focus after all of that. I really wish we had aperture control in the top dock, just like we had at launch. At launch, we had a little button at the top that could toggle F1.9 or F4. And then the first update to this got rid of it. And it killed me because that was way better. It was way better than what they came up with after that first major like launch update for the phone. I'm telling you, if the only requirements you have for photography are pull phone out of pocket, push red button for shutter, and put phone back in pocket, you should not be spending more than Pixel 6a money on a phone. Like, stop buying above that. Because genuinely, the best experience for phone out of pocket, push shutter, put phone back in pocket is a Pixel 6a. I bet the Pixel 7a is going to be very good too. And if you want to get a little fancier, you can step up to like a Pixel 7 and get the larger image sensor. But you don't get much from that better hardware if your experience is that streamlined, that point and shoot. If you pull your phone out of your pocket and you tap on someone's face because you really want to make sure that the phone is specifically focusing on one subject and you care about nailing the focus on that one subject, and then you angle your phone slightly so that you can frame a part of the background against your subject, and you have an idea for all of that, and then you push your shutter, that's when you start having good reasons to spend a little bit more on a phone. That's where spending for a Pixel 7 Pro starts to make more sense, or even a Pixel 7, going from a Pixel 6a to a Pixel 7 to a Pixel 7 Pro. The second you have some idea of framing or composition, or you're trying to do something like shooting a candid across a dark living room, right? When I got to visit my nephew for the very first time in the middle of the pandemic, and we were all terrified about spreading disease, and my sister has cats, and I'm deathly allergic to cats, and I'm wearing a mask. I had the Pixel 6 Pro, and there was just this one shot of my brother-in-law holding my nephew, and it's across their living room. And there my nephew is laughing, that little chubby-cheeked baby laugh, like that little baby guffaw. And my brother-in-law's eyes are just sparkling, like you could not see more love between a father and a son. And how dumb would that have been for me to shove a phone in his face and try and get a close-up photo? But I'm across the living room, and I switch to the telephoto, and the Pixel nails this low-light, indoor, dimly-lit moment. And I got to stay way far back, and I got to see it even better for using my telephoto camera than even if I had just been using my eyes. That's where you start spending up. When you want to do things like that, that's where it makes more sense to go from a Pixel 6a to a Pixel 7 or a 7 Pro. When you really want to start creating content, that's where you start looking at the ultra tier phones. That's where a Vivo Pro Plus makes more sense. That's where a Xiaomi Ultra makes more sense. That's even where a Samsung Note 23 makes more sense. And that's the part of the conversation we keep losing. This phone is fine in a very average, basic, point-and-shoot, just-click-the-shutter-button, auto-HDR kind of operation. But I don't think you get that much out of it than if you'd had a $400 Pixel. I don't think you get that much more out of it, I should say. The $400 Pixel is going to do the out-of-pocket, shutter, back-in-pocket action as good or better in many situations. But the second you start framing, adjusting, looking at your background, looking at your subject, considering the difference between nice portraiture or action candid photography or sports, crafting the look of the video so that it complements a certain idea or a look. We were at the beach on a really gray day. I'm going to be adding a bit more contrast to some of those photos. I really want the gray of that beach day to be felt. And then the brightness of my daughter's face kind of popping off the background of a platinum silver Pacific Ocean and gray clouds that were raining off in the distant horizon. I want the feel of that to matter. That's where the Xiaomi 13 Ultra shines. And you can feel every ounce of that computational performance and every aspect of the various camera sensors on it and how each one of those contributes to the image that I had in my head not the image that an AI had for pet mode or food mode or starry night mode or fake moon zoom or anything like that. I'm doing the thinking. The Xiaomi 13 Ultra lets me do that. Other phones don't let you do the thinking. They try to take over the finished aspect or the finished project, what you're trying to shoot. Whew. So yes, feeling real good. Hey, Sean P's in the chat. Sean P, you got your order in yet for the Xiaomi 13 Ultra? I know we're kind of teasing you a little bit, but have you cracked yet? Or are you waiting on the, are you going for the international? I think it's totally fair if you're going for the international. If you're not really concerned about the international, then I hope you've got your order in now. Do I have coffee? I'm out of coffee. Let me drink some more water here real quick, and we'll wrap up with just some of these last comments here. Oh, Sean P, you are killing me. Well, no, it is through no contrarian aspect of this conversation. I am full force passionate about that one. Michael Peppertech, a more tuned image from a finely tuned eye requiring the data and complexity of a larger sensor and pro modes along with interpretation of the raw data you can capture. That is a wordier version of what I'm trying to express, but absolutely agree. Not only that, the optical differences between a bigger sensor and a smaller sensor require the part of the conversation where someone who is not careful on a 1-inch camera sensor in where they are focusing, or if they let the phone do all the focusing for them, will likely miss more shots than a phone with a smaller image sensor. The depth of field matters tremendously if we're talking about the average consumers. Because let's say you tap to focus on someone's face, and then you lean that much. Where you tapped is already falling out of focus. That's how shallow the depth of field is. If I'm framing a head and shoulder portrait of someone from the main sensor, that's too close. The lens is too wide for that. But it might happen. You could be in that kind of closer. You want the blurriest background for what's going on behind your subject. But if you do that, you have to know at kind of an arm's length. So if I frame a head and shoulder portrait, I'm kind of right about here, kind of bent elbow, this distance right here. That's really closing in on the minimum focusing distance of this lens. The distance between the bridge of my nose and my eye can already be falling out of focus. So if I don't nail focus on my eye, this photo will be blurry and soft of me before we start talking about the focus behind me. That's not going to happen on a Pixel 6a. A Pixel 6a is going to nail that kind of shot if you're not taking the little bit of care to getting that shot. We don't talk about this stuff as to what really will benefit the consumer. We talk about this stuff for whatever is going to be popular on YouTube's algorithm so that we make the most money on our YouTube videos. But anyone who's trying to sit there and say that you need a Note 23, a Galaxy S23 Ultra to have the gooder cameras, you might be falling into a trap where it really isn't a better camera for your needs. Oh, you got to have the iPhone 14 Pro. Those have the best cameras. You could be falling into situations where those cameras are not complementing your style of photography or your needs as a consumer. And surprise, surprise, you got to spend significantly more money on those cameras. You got to spend more on cameras that work for you less if you don't really talk about what these things are built to accomplish with just the littlest of nuance. It's the same thing. I'm streaming this on an Xperia 1 Mark IV. For the Instagram feed, I'm streaming this on my main camera for the Twitch feed. But the Xperia doesn't have this crazy 1-inch type sensor. But guess what? The Xperia is way better at speed. That autofocus lock, 4K at 120 frames per second video, it is a speed demon. And that's why it's a professional grade camera. And you can do incredible slow motion video with it. You know, take 4K 120, slow it down to 30 frames per second. It is a different pro tier aspect of photography and videography than what Xiaomi is trying to accomplish. So, it's a lot. The Xiaomi 13 Ultra camera review is going to take me a bit because it is four really good cameras on the back of that phone. It's a lot. Every setup that I do requires multiple exposures. I want to test the difference between Leica Authentic and Leica Vibrant. I want to look at the different video features and what's going on with the audio when I'm doing video capture and what difference does the HDR toggle make. And then I get to the main sensor and I've got to say, well, is this a situation where I wanted to use f1.9 or is this a situation where I wanted to use f4? And like every part of that. So if I do one setup of a flower photo for my camera review, that's like 10 photos that I might need to take to get every permutation of color processing, HDR processing, aperture, and pro versus... Oh, and there's a new expert RAW mode. So this is the first time Xiaomi has done a more computationally aggressive DNG, like Samsung Expert RAW and Vivo Super RAW and Apple Pro RAW. They're not RAW. They're not real RAW. They're HDR images, but they're saved in a DNG container. So then I've got to look at the difference between manual JPEG, manual traditional RAW, and manual Expert RAW. And that's three other photos that I've got to take. And then I can do the permutation of, do I want Expert RAW f1.9 or Expert RAW, Expert RAW f1.8 or Expert RAW f4? Do I want Expert RAW Leica Authentic f1.8? Do I want standard RAW Leica Vibrant f4? That's just in the manual mode for the main camera sensor. So this camera's gonna be working me real hard for a little bit. This is not going to be a phone where I'm immediately going to put out like, and this is the full camera deep dive. It only took me 3 days. Anyone who's putting out a review on this phone, a review on this phone, is lying. Because we know the next couple software updates are going to improve and adjust a whole bunch of stuff. We know they are not familiar with this camera app. I have shot on Xiaomi now pretty heavily over the last year, thanks to the 12S Ultra. There is no way. There is no way they have followed all of the differences of what the camera app can do. A review right now is a lie. There is no way you know what this is going to do. So Osman Kaluj, what is the difference between those types of RAW and something like the Xperia RAW? Okay, so a Sony Xperia shoots very much like a camera. You push the shutter button and the phone will take all of the image data on the sensor and put it in a container called the DNG. And that's a larger bucket of data. It's not a very pleasant image, but you use that data to edit, and then you arrive at the JPEG that you really want to share and save. That's the finished image. A Xiaomi has that same ability too. You push the shutter once, it sucks up all of the information in that moment from the sensor, doesn't do anything to it. It is raw data. These new processed modes are like taking a bracket. So Expert RAW, Super RAW, Pro RAW, they're not raw. They are heavily processed images, but they take a stack of exposures. I don't know how many, each manufacturer is a little different, but it's usually around 3 to 7 individual raw images that are all stacked and smushed together. And then, processing is applied. HDR effects are applied. There's noise removal that scrubs out noise from the images. And then all of that information is repackaged into a DNG. Expert RAW is not raw. Super RAW is not raw. Pro RAW is not raw. It's like shooting a bracket. So it's a shortcut. You take a mirrorless camera, you can shoot a bracket. That's where you change the exposure. You start with a really dark image, and then you move to a really bright image over 3 to 5 separate shutters. We are now doing that in phones, handheld, and with one shutter press. So that's what it's trying to accomplish. So you have the regular RAW mode, the traditional RAW mode, and that is one image, RAW data, good to go. Then you have this stacked DNG mode, which is called Expert RAW. and it's like a shortcut. So instead of taking a bunch of raw files to your computer, and having your computer smush all the data together and then editing on like Lightroom or I use Affinity for photo editing, the phone is doing that in camera for you. So it's just a shortcut. You don't have to then take a bunch of files to another computer to start editing. You can start editing directly from the Expert RAW. So Xiaomi has never done an Expert RAW before. This is the first year that they've done a processed DNG file. It's a lot. There's a lot going on. It's real tough. Oh, Malik, yeah. I like the in-depth insight on the 13 Ultra. It sounds like more and more of these 1-inch sensor phones are categorized as the photo enthusiast's phones. We do not categorize phones well. Look at every review where it's like, but average consumers will use this phone and only do the basics. Look at this stream. I've talked about the Sonys. Those are heavy videography focused and action photography focused devices. I've held up the Vivos and the Xiaomi Ultras and the 1-inch camera sensor phones, and those are heavily photography focused with great video features. We've talked about Samsungs and iPhones being kind of all-rounder camera platforms. We've talked about Pixels being the best streamlined point-and-shoot camera experience. These are all fundamentally different photography experiences and video experiences. And we haven't even touched on like the rest of the phone. What makes the rest of the phone different? If you're telling me you want content creation capabilities, you got to go to 1-inch type sensors. If you're telling me you want gaming capabilities, we have purpose-built gaming phones. You're telling me you want the absolute best experiences for productivity and laptop replacement, you're looking at Moto and Samsung. Like, every single time you watch a review and they're like, but what is an average consumer going to do with this? That person doesn't exist. The person who's average is likely shopping below $400 or actually below $500 for a phone. And it's, they might take a couple photos a month. They probably scroll through TikToks and social media. They need it for communication, text messaging of some kind. And maybe they listen to some music on it. Why would you spend more than $300 on that? I've got a Vivo over here. This Vivo V27 Pro is ridiculous overkill. It's absurd overkill for average consumers. And I want to say that this phone launched at like 350 euro. Like the order of magnitude more power you have on this phone makes no sense at all for, oh, you know, I kind of like scroll through my Instagram feed a little. I need a powerful phone for that. I need like a laptop grade SoC in here. Because sometimes I even open YouTube. Like, that's average. That's the vast majority of consumers out there. The peak of the bell curve, right? The top point of the most users and the broadest experiences, like communication, social media, occasionally taking a couple photos. That's it. Why would you spend more than $400 on that? I don't get it. I really don't. So we need to do a better job of classifying. You can get a really inexpensive productivity phone. You can get like a Moto Stylus. It's like a $200 phone and it comes with a little stylus and it's really underpowered, but it can do fine touch point stylus interactions and it's pretty good. Like, you know what you're getting it for, battery life and touching the screen with a stick instead of with your finger. Great. But if you're talking about content creation, there is a new tier of ultra phones and high-end premium tier phones, over $1,000 phones. And the reason why I would pick up a Xiaomi 13 Ultra is because this phone at $1,400 to import is giving me close to the same capabilities as $2,000 worth of mirrorless camera and lens. And this is way easier to pack. It's got a ton more storage because I opted for the 1 terabyte version. It's got video out so I can hook it up to another monitor or display. It's easier to mount and clip to various tripods and accessories. It weighs a lot less. And it is also its own editing and rendering capabilities. If I shoot a bunch of video on my Lumix, I can't do anything with it out in the field. I have to transfer it to another computer. As I was shooting video on my Xiaomi, I was able to drop that into a LumaFusion timeline and get my little family beach day trip mostly cut up at the beach. Like, that was what was so fun and relaxing, was like, I shot all this video and I shot all these photos and I don't have to take them home to edit them. So that to me is the world of difference that we do not bring up in these reviews. So Ravs 4989, how are Chinese phones with security and privacy compared to Samsung? It is not whether or not a Chinese company made the phone. It is where that phone was supposed to be sold. And I very much believe if we could get the funding to do a proper study on Samsung and Apple devices, a Samsung phone built by Samsung but meant to be sold in China would be just as leaky with your data as a Chinese phone built for China. The most recent study that we saw took Chinese phones with Chinese ROMs versus Chinese phones with global ROMs. And wouldn't you know it, in areas of the world that have stricter regulations on consumer data privacy policies, those Chinese phones weren't really any different than Samsung or Apple or Motorola, or actually Motorola is now technically a Chinese manufacturer too. But if you took a Chinese phone with a Chinese ROM and you traveled to the EU, all of the apps and system software and permissions that were already granted was still sending your data back to Chinese servers. So I'm not a fan of this China bad xenophobic style of conversation about phones. If you take a Samsung phone that was built for Russia and you log into it, you will be met with a splash screen of Russia-approved apps that you should install on your phone. And you have to look at what of those apps were already granted permissions to start using your personal data. Samsung caved to the Russian government. Apple caved to the Russian government. And I would imagine that if you buy an iPhone for China, it would likely behave the same. So it's never as simple as China bad. GDPR and all of the other consumer protection regulations are working. Like, they're, you know, at this point, they're kind of the same. So there is no fear for me if you pick up a Xiaomi with a global ROM, or you pick up a Chinese Xiaomi and then you flash a global ROM, you're probably just as good as any other manufacturer. Like, they should be pretty much the same. but we got to wrap this up. I am so sorry. We've got so much chat going on. And like I said, this week was crazy for the news. This was a fun experiment. I think I'm going to try and also just keep a phone going for the stream just to wrap us up, because my 2-hour podcast is now closing in on 3 hours. I want to see from 92% on the Sony Xperia 1 Mark IV to 54% with 3 hours. 3 hours of streaming over Wi-Fi. No thermals, no stutters, no hiccups that I could find. I'm really digging this. Android 13 Android 13 on the Xperia 1 Mark IV has been surprisingly solid. Phone is still hot. 8 Gen 1 is still thirsty. You can run it down when you're on 5G, but this Wi-Fi performance has been fantastic. And again, doing all this without any hiccups or any issues with battery life. 3 hours and I'm only down to 50%. not bad at all right, folks, so we're gonna put a pin in this. We gotta wrap this up. I gotta stop talking. My voice is dying right now, so lots of stuff to come. I have so many videos in the pipeline right now. Vivo comparisons. I've got the laptop and tablet comparisons for the OnePlus pad. I've got another thing on my desk that I can't show you or talk about yet that I think is actually going to be a little controversial. There is a ton of stuff that's happening, and I still want to keep up with like some of my battery coverage and camping and disaster prep tech. We're getting into the summer months again, so I want to talk about that activity and e-bikes. Man, this is so much fun. This really has been so much more fun finally getting to show y'all like some of this stuff, because I've been on embargoes for so long, and getting to finally open this up and like, hey, this is, like, I've been playing with it and it's really cool. You should check it out. It's really good times. So, folks, I want you all to have an incredible week. I want you to do awesome with your technology. I want you to be awesome with your technology. And I want you to take care of yourselves so you can keep being the amazing resources for your family and friends. Take care of yourself so that you can take care of others. And I always appreciate those of you who are willing to step up and tackle a part of that conversation. Because this stuff is way more fun when we really point out how different these solutions still are. And I think it's really easy to let the apathy kind of wash over. A phone is a phone is a phone, and a phone does phone things, and a tablet does tablet things, and average consumers. And that's nonsense. You really want something fresh? You really want something fun? There's something you can do. There's a resource that you can tap. And often, it's the folks in my chat that are doing that. Hey, Kaz, never stop being controversial. You're the only one doing it. There are a few of us out there. We're just a lot harder to find because controversy is not fun for the YouTube algorithm. And again, and thank you everybody who was tapping in on the Instagram. Like, this was fun. I'm going to try and keep doing this for the Monday morning streams, just kind of seeing some of those comments pop up. I know I wasn't able to kind of keep everyone, sort of popped up on screen, but I feel like this was worth sustaining as an experiment. So catch you back here next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. Be safe. Take care. I love y'all. I'll catch you back.